Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
Breaker, breaker, 1-9. I'm in outer space with a microphone.
Like 9/11, this podcast has been premeditated and parts were pre-recorded. Unlike 9/11, this podcast has not been approved by the regime in power or the Council on Foreign Relations. But since they're listening, we just want them to know that it's just business, nothing personal. Because this isn't a coincidence, just the consequence of 9/11 synchronicity.
Well, yeah, that's right.
Ain't it a little early for that? Ain't Anna coming tomorrow?
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
Former Beatle John Lennon is dead. He was shot and killed Monday night in front of his apartment building in Manhattan. Seven-3. Okay, you're on the air at CBS FM. Do you have a question?
Last winter, the FBI was praised for its speed in cracking the case of the World Trade Center bombing and bringing four suspects to trial. Now, there is some evidence that the FBI may have known of the plot in advance through an informant and might even have stopped the bombing that killed six people. Correspondent Jacqueline Adams has the story.
FBI agents might have been able to prevent last February's deadly explosion at New York's World Trade Center. They discussed secretly substituting harmless powder for the explosives, but they didn't, according to the FBI's own informant, Imad Salem. Unbeknownst to the FBI at the time, Salem recorded many of his conversations with his handlers.
I'm holding 903 pages of draft transcripts.
Kunstler confirmed newspaper reports of the Salem transcripts. In one, Salem complains to an FBI agent, "Since the bomb went off, I feel terrible. I feel bad. I feel here is people who don't listen." The agent replies, "Hey, I mean, it wasn't like you didn't try and I didn't try. You can't force people to do the right thing."
There is material in here to show gross governmental misconduct.
Today, attorneys for the defendants in the ongoing World Trade Center bombing case formally asked for the transcripts of Salem's tapes.
Quite frankly, it's beyond me why now, the fourth week into the trial, we still don't have these materials.
Prosecutors have refused to comment publicly, but legal experts say the defense may have no right to those transcripts.
You're going to help people lose.
Well, I think it's all about support, isn't it? It is a thought, isn't it?
Yes.
But it is about support, and Weight Watchers is really about help.
People, you know, the kids today think that they invented mojitos. They're in the bars now. They're very popular. My grandparents were drinking mojitos.
And we do have some breaking news that we want to bring you around, and we're going to go to a picture, a live picture from New York City.
That a plane may have hit one of the two towers.
What do the intelligence people there say about that?
The intelligence community for some time has been warning in a steady drumbeat, Bryant, that Osama bin Laden has not been heard from now, frankly, since the beginning of the year, the USS.
Some of the key suspects come to mind, Osama bin Laden.
As you've studied him, what can you tell us about him that we don't know? Take us to the core of Osama bin Laden.
To say to the world that this is a unified nation in the face of tragedy.
In places near to where the tragedies are playing out and far away, Americans are trying to figure out what to do in the face of hopeless grief and sympathy and anger.
Some Palestinians are openly delighted over the attacks. Images like these have embarrassed moderate Arabs. They know that they risk hardening world opinion against the Palestinians, and perhaps even against Arabs in general.
The second ranking person at the Defense Department has laid out what he says will be eventually a sustained U.S. military effort. And so what needs to be done is mount a swift, sure, overwhelming military operation that deals with Osama bin Laden and the Taliban because they've been protecting him.
It's a very sophisticated operation.
Oh, you bet. This is serious business. And there's not one of those. There are many of those.
Are you concerned about asbestos contamination?
The health department has done tests, and at this point is not concerned.
We have first-hand descriptions of biological weapons factories on wheels and on rails.
The Iraqi regime has plotted to develop anthrax.
Of course we're after Saddam Hussein, bin Laden. He's isolated.
The terrorists attacked us and killed 3,000 of our citizens before we started the freedom agenda in the Middle East. What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing.
The United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war.
In a limited military action in Libya, in support of an international effort to protect Libyan civilians.
But the death of Al-Qaeda's founder and spiritual leader does not end the terror threat. Across America today, heavily armed police bolstered patrols at airports from Boston to Los Angeles.
There are things that are being now done in Heathrow Airport that, as an experiment of using iris scan as a way to check into the airport.
Investigations are often slowed by a limit on the reach of federal search warrants.
Says he's been treated like a terror suspect every time he flies. The airlines say he's on a TSA watch list, even though Mikey is just 8 years old.
The CIA admitted that waterboarding was used on terror suspects in 2002 and 2003, but claimed its agents couldn't be prosecuted because they'd been told it was legal.
I don't want the mosque here.
Why don't you want the
mosque? Why? Because I don't want to go through the Constitution. I know what the Constitution says. But they are spitting in our face, the mosque people.
Our nation is at war against a far-reaching network of violence and hatred, and that we will do whatever it takes to defeat them and defend our country.
We will incarcerate people preventively, preventive incarceration. Indefinite detention without trial. That's what this is.
Right now, the Bush people are bringing out their mission accomplished sign because they've not only gotten Obama to protect Bush and Cheney and others from any criminal investigation on torture, but he's now gone even further than they did in the protection of unlawful surveillance.
I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. I said, we've had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it And they made that decision to pull, and then we watched the building collapse.
Good afternoon, Loazzo Company.
Sorry, is this controlled demolitions?
Yes, it is.
Okay, I was wondering if there was someone I could talk to briefly, just to ask a question I had.
What kind of question?
Well, I just wanted to know what a term meant in demolition terms.
Okay, what type of term?
Well, if you were in the demolition business and you said the term pull it, I was wondering what exactly that would mean.
Pull it?
Yeah.
Hold on a minute.
Thank you.
Sir?
Yes?
Pull it is when they actually pull it down.
Oh. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Scoggins Military, Boston Center. Just had a report that American 11 is still in the air and it's on its way towards, heading towards Washington.
Okay, American 11 is still in the air? On its way towards Washington?
There was definitely another aircraft that hit the tower. That's the latest report we have.
Okay.
I'm going to try to confirm an ID for you, but I would assume he's somewhere over either New Jersey or somewhere further south.
Okay, so American 11 isn't the hijack at all then, right?
No, he is a hijack.
American 11 is a hijack.
Yeah.
And he's going into Washington?
It could be a third aircraft.
It could be a third aircraft going on to Washington. Do you have a Mode 3 on him, sir?
No, Mode 3, we're trying to get a radio DME if I can. This is a report ahead from Washington Center. You might want to get someone on another phone talking to Washington Center, see if they have him tracked up.
Copy that, sir.
And then get maybe DC Guard or somebody up there on that, on the aircraft.
Okay, do you have a let long right now on it?
I will try to get one.
Okay, copy, thanks.
On the morning of September 11, 2001, 19 men armed with box cutters directed by a man on dialysis in a cave fortress halfway around the world using a satellite phone and a laptop directed the most sophisticated penetration of the most heavily defended airspace in the world, overpowering the passengers and the military combat-trained pilots on four commercial aircraft before flying those planes wildly off course for over an hour without being molested by a single fighter interceptor. These 19 hijackers, devout religious fundamentalists who like to drink alcohol, snort cocaine, and live with pink-haired strippers, managed to knock down three buildings with two planes in New York. While in Washington, a pilot who couldn't handle a single-engine Cessna was able to fly a 757 in an 8,000-foot descending 270-degree corkscrew turn to come exactly level with the ground, hitting the Pentagon in the budget analyst office where DoD staffers were working on the mystery of the $2.3 trillion that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld had announced missing from the Pentagon's coffers in a press conference the day before, on September 10th, 2001. Luckily, the news anchors knew who did it within minutes.
Osama bin Laden.
The pundits knew within hours.
Osama bin Laden.
The administration knew within the day.
Terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them.
And the evidence literally fell into the FBI's lap.
That a hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
But for some reason, a bunch of crazy conspiracy theorists demanded an investigation into the greatest attack on American soil in history. That investigation was delayed, underfunded, set up to fail, a conflict of interest, and a cover-up from start to finish. It was based on testimony extracted through torture, the records of which were destroyed. It failed to mention the existence of WTC-7, Able Danger, PTEC, Sibel Edmonds, OBL and the CIA, and the drills of hijacked aircraft being flown into buildings that were being simulated at the precise same time that those events were actually happening. It was lied to by the Pentagon, the CIA, the Bush administration, and as for Bush and Cheney, well, no one knows what they told it because they testified in secret, off the record, not under oath, and behind closed doors. It didn't bother to look at who funded the attacks because that question is ultimately of little practical significance. Still, the 9/11 Commission did brilliantly, answering all of the questions the public had, except most of the victims' family members' questions, and pinned blame on all the people responsible, although no one so much as lost their job, determining the attacks were
failure of imagination.
Because
nobody in our government, at least, and I don't think the prior government that could envision flying airplanes into buildings.
Except the Pentagon, FEMA, NORAD, and the NRO. The DIA destroyed 2.5 terabytes of data on Able Danger, but that's okay because it probably wasn't important. The SEC destroyed their records on the investigation into the insider trading before the attacks, but that's okay because destroying the records of the largest investigation in SEC history is just part of routine record keeping. NIST has classified the data that they used for their model of WTC-7's collapse, but that's okay because knowing how they made their model of the collapse would jeopardize public safety. The FBI has argued that all material related to their investigation of 9/11 should be kept secret from the public, but that's okay because the FBI probably has nothing to hide. This man never existed, nor is anything he had to say worthy of your attention, and if you say otherwise, you are a paranoid conspiracy theorist and deserve to be shunned by all of humanity. Likewise him, 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 and her. And her, and her, and him. Osama bin Laden lived in a cave fortress in the hills of Afghanistan, but somehow got away. Then he was hiding out in Tora Bora, but somehow got away. Then he lived in Abbottabad for years, taunting the most comprehensive intelligence dragnet employing the most sophisticated technology in the history of the world for a decade, releasing video after video with complete impunity and getting younger and younger as he did so, before finally being found in a daring SEAL team raid which wasn't recorded on video, in which he didn't resist or use his wife as a human shield, and in which these crack special forces operatives panicked and killed this unarmed man, supposedly the best source of intelligence about those dastardly terrorists on the entire planet. Then they dumped his body in the ocean before telling anyone about it. Then a couple dozen of that team's members died in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan. This is the story of 9/11, brought to you by the media which told you the hard truths about
his head could be seen to move violently forward.
And
they took the babies out of incubators.
And
mobile production facilities.
And
the rescue of Jessica Lynch.
If you have any questions about this story, you are a batshit, paranoid, tinfoil, dog-abusing baby hater and will be reviled by everyone. If you love your country and or freedom, happiness, rainbows, rock and roll, puppy dogs, apple pie, and your grandma, you will never ever express doubts about any part of this story to anyone. Ever. This has been a public service announcement by the Friends of the FBI, CIA, NSA, DIA, SEC, MSM, White House, NIST, and the 9/11 Commission. Because ignorance is strength.
Science is never secret when it's done right. Science is a way of finding out that is self-correcting. And involves many people. Science isn't science unless it's published, unless it's openly published and made available for criticism. The thing that's most important about science is that it's a way of knowing, and it's a way of knowing that anyone can participate in. At the end of any kind of science activity, people will agree that they have collected evidence that illustrates a hypothesis, and if the evidence is contradictory to the hypothesis, one has to abandon that hypothesis and look for another one.
And now to another firestorm, this one having to do with the report from the EPA's Inspector General, the man or woman who basically patrols, polices the EPA. It concerns the air people were breathing at Ground Zero in the hours, the days, the months following the 9/11 attack. How safe was it, or wasn't it, and what were people told about its safety and why?
Getting the truth and protecting people are part of the EPA's mandate. But if the air at Ground Zero was safe, why were so many people getting sick? Even some of EPA's own staff doubted the agency's assurances about safety. Among them, senior policy analyst Hugh Kaufman.
Mrs. Whitman went on national TV, smiled at the camera, and told everybody everything is safe, and it wasn't.
As I say, you know asbestos was in there, is in those buildings, lead is in those buildings, there are the VOCs. However, the concentrations are such that they don't pose a health hazard. We're going to make sure everybody's safe.
More than 2,700 people were killed at the World Trade Center on 9/11. More than 2,000 were injured. But the casualties did not end that day. More than 40,000 people worked for months at the site amid toxic air and debris. A new report out today in the medical journal Lancet followed the health of New York City firefighters and tried to answer a question that has haunted all Ground Zero workers since. Did their heroism after 9/11 lead to a higher risk of cancer? Dr. John LaPook has the story.
After the towers fell, fireman Ray Pfeiffer arrived with Engine 40. He joined the search for his fallen buddies.
What we saw down there, no human should ever have to see.
He worked in a choking dust cloud, a brew of pulverized cement and known carcinogens such as asbestos, benzene, PCBs, and dioxin.
We're in toxic soup. You know, who knows what you were breathing in because it was so thick.
Pfeiffer worked on the pile for 7 months. 9 years later,
the doctor said to me, he says, Ray, it's stage 4 cancer.
The diagnosis was kidney cancer that had spread to his bones. Doctors removed part of his leg and hip and a kidney. He's not the only first responder who became ill.
there's a lot of guys that are sick on this job. A lot of guys. You know, a lot of guys got cancer.
The Lancet Medical Journal report is the first comprehensive cancer study of New York City firefighters after 9/11.
Now, shifting gears into another 9/11 area, I noticed the cover of Time magazine last week says the new greatest generation, military veterans, first responders, folks like that, how they're going to lead the leadership, you know, gap in America. The problem is the firemen, the police, the military that were heroes of 9/11, they've been barred from being at Ground Zero. That's now come out. So they've been barred from being there. And they now, even the French news agency today reports that they've got massive increases in cancer. And the reason that they're barred is because they're afraid to have them there at Ground Zero with the president and stuff, because they don't buy any of the official fables. They know the dust was deadly. So what does it say about the system having to circle the wagons that even the cops, the military, and the fire people are not welcome at the 10th anniversary?
Well, let's not forget that in the very days after 9/11, the government was caught in a brazen and transparent lie when the EPA announced that the air was safe to breathe. People trusted the government, and years later, the majority of 9/11 first responders are either dead or are sick and dying of these illnesses. So that's why they don't want them there, because the majority of people who are actually involved in the rescue mission are aware of 9/11 truth, because people like We Are Change have held numerous events to support these individuals as the government betrayed them, withheld the payments, which they're now finally being forced to give to them in drips and drops. But exactly, that's why they don't want them at the official memorial. They only want politicians there who can use it as a soapbox, as a photo op, because these first responders are genuine people who have found the truth, who have come to the truth, and many of them obviously witnessed the explosions, the demolitions on the day itself. That's why the government does not want them there.
On September 11th, 2001, along with hundreds of my fellow troops, I went to Ground Zero. No one asked us, no orders were given. We went because our city, our country, our neighbors were under attack, and we knew what to do. I want to tell you tonight about the people we call heroes, about the people who we applauded and put up banners for and wrote songs about and put into music videos and put movies on about and forgot about, that they were abandoned in their hour of greatest need and are still in growing numbers, living in terrible physical and economic circumstances as they struggle with the carcinogenic effects of the toxic chemical soup Ground Zero became. How many people in here live in New York City? Take a look at everybody with their hands up. Can this side of the room, everybody stand up? Everybody on this side, if you're all rescue workers, will be dead in 4 years. Thank you. You'd all be dead in 4 years. That's our statistics. That's what's happening. In 7 years, it doubles. This is what Mount Sinai proved in a 17,000-page study. I want to tell you about how the mayor refused to accept the fact that not dozens, not hundreds, but many thousands of us were contaminated, sickened, and poisoned by the most toxic combinations of building materials in the history of disaster relief. And that for five terrible years, he ignored that fact. That's not how you treat people the city considered heroes. It's only been 5 years. 5 years of our family members watching us drop dead. And every time Popular Mechanics calls the people of this movement nuts, and every time Time magazine dismisses real hard physical evidence that a new investigation needs to be launched into how concrete was pulverized, every time Time magazine dismisses that evidence and instead writes a two-page article about the psychology of the conspiracy movement. These propagandists, professional liars and tools who cannot even, by any stretch of the imagination, be considered journalists, strike another nail into the coffin of another rescue worker. We who are still dying from 9/11, who went into the towers and into that pile, now live with those buildings in our lungs and digestive systems and our blood. And if you allow these scumbags to strip you and this movement of our legitimacy, you condemn first responders to death. We know what they did, they being the government. We know what they're capable of, and we know that they can do it again. How was the concrete pulverized? How was glass micronized into dust? And how was there molten steel? But a passport survived. What were those explosions reported by the FDNY? And why weren't the planes intercepted? And how did Hani Hanor learn to fly like that? I don't think we're crazy. Everyone in this administration had motive, intent, and opportunity. Conspiracies are only evidence the courts won't hear. We came to your rescue on 9/11. Now thousands of us and our families need you to come for 2 hours. For myself and far too many of us, research and the effective treatment is going to arrive far too late. I have double metastasizations in both lungs. That's just a reality. We were also killed on 9/11. Avenge us.
Why do people resist this information, the information that shows that the official story about 9/11 cannot be true? What I've learned is that as humans, each of us have a worldview. And that worldview is usually formed in great part by the culture we grow up in. When we hear information that contradicts our worldview, social psychologists call the resulting insecurity cognitive dissonance. For example, with 9/11, we have one cognition, which is what the official story of 9/11, what our government told us, what our media repeated to us over and over, that 19 Muslims attacked us. On the other hand, we have what scientists, researchers, architects, engineers are now beginning to tell us, which is that there is evidence that shows that the official story cannot be true. So now we've lost our sense of security. We are starting to feel vulnerable. Now we're confused.
9/11 truth challenges some of our most fundamental beliefs about our government and about our country. When your beliefs are challenged or when two beliefs are inconsistent, cognitive dissonance is created. 9/11 truth challenges the beliefs that our country protects us and keeps us safe and that America is the good guy.
I was chairman of the 9/11 commission, governor of New Jersey, where we had a lot of the victims.
My son Bobby, 26 years old, worked at Merrill Lynch, died on 9/11.
I'm just happy and delighted to be able to support the families in any way I can.
As a family member, I certainly don't think the 9/11 Commission, which the book is right here, has answered any of the questions that I found pertinent to 9/11.
I have to ask a serious question. Why did you decide to keep the outline of the commission that was written by Philip Zelikow before the 9/11 Commission report? Why did you decide to keep it secret
when it was determined he outlined 9/11? He outlined what happened there.
You know,
he outlined it.
You're a little...
With all due respect, how am I nuts?
No, I'm not.
How am I nuts?
That's monumental news, that the outline of the investigation of my son's murder was out before they even started the first day investigation.
Philip Zelikow wrote the report before 9/11 was investigated. Before it was investigated, he wrote it.
He actually didn't.
Yes, he did.
No one knew about this outline. Then it came out. And he's dogging it, saying, oh, well, I didn't know anything about it, and walked away.
Mr. King, I mean, seriously, you make yourself look very guilty.
Please,
hey.
This is for the families.
It is. And their questions were never answered.
At long last, have you got no shame?
70% of their questions were never answered by your investigation. How do you feel about that?
And when they get a strong question, like Luke just mentioned, they're going to back away. Because basically they have no balls.
Come on.
This is for the families. It's
it
not
is,
for
and
you.
Their questions were never answered. You. What happened to Building 7? That was never in there. Seriously, sir. Come on. the least thing you do is at least answer something. Even if you don't believe in what I believe in, you don't have to make yourself look guilty by walking away.
The Keynes, the Hamiltons, they are part of the power structure. Look at the background of Keynes. Look at the background of Hamilton. They're involved in oil. It behooves them to keep their mouths shut.
But Keynes, seriously, man. The biggest crime in history.
The governor of history.
And then the family members' questions were never answered. 70% of their questions were never answered. You know, it was not an investigation. You even said you were set up to fail. And how can we understand that? Like, how can we get justice for something that you said you were set up to fail? And then Philip Zelikow, who wrote a book with Condoleezza Rice.
You know more than him, so you don't need to ask him any questions. You have
Philip Zelikow works with Condoleezza Rice. He wrote a book. He wrote that Iraq was responsible for 9/11. And then he wrote the report before the commission even started.
He was part of the transition team of George Bush when he became president in 2000. Wrote a book with Condoleezza Rice. So he's part of the system. So he knew what was wanted to be written in this book. He had the outline of this book.
There's so much evidence. The Able Danger programs that were destroyed and deleted, sir. Don't you think that there was a huge, massive cover-up of the events of 9/11 that you took place in that you need to talk about because that's why it's so important, sir?
So what you want is the truth about who murdered your son. That's all I'm in this for. Who murdered my son?
We're just trying to find out the truth. And your silence looks very guilty. I hate to say it. If you don't believe in what I'm saying, just answer the question. But when you run away, you implicate yourself.
Let's have a new, or not a new, the only 9/11 investigation, because this was not an investigation. Benveniste had even said, remember, this is not an investigation, it is merely an exposition. Now what does that mean? It's just putting facts out onto the table, and then you have to make your own decision. Well, I know what my decisions are, that a new investigation has to take place.
There is a peaceful solution called Peace Revolution. Now let's take back America. There's a war and we're in it. I know we can win it. So let's take back America. There was a dream, so believe it and get ready to receive it. Now let's take back America.
Today being September 11th, 2011, I thought it would be appropriate to go back in time and observe some of the patterns which have preceded and which were consequent to 9/11. I opened this episode with the interruption in television programming on November 22nd, 1963, and Walter Cronkite's announcement that President John F. Kennedy had just been shot 3 times. I then continued with a radio dial scan from the night that John Lennon was assassinated, December 8, 1980. Continuing on, I played a CBS News broadcast featuring Dan Rather, informing the public that the FBI had foreknowledge and actively participated in the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. After that, I played the interruption of morning programming on September 11, 2001, which continued into a brief history of the 10 years of war which have followed 9/11, a montage composed by James Corbett, followed by a recording of air traffic controllers reporting that Flight 11 was still in the air well after the North Tower exploded, bringing legitimate reason for the questioning of the methods by which the planes were being identified on that day. Next up was Larry Silverstein mentioning that he said, "Pull it," in relation to the World Trade Center 7 building. And then you heard Jeff in Canada calling Controlled Demolition Incorporated, inquiring into the epistemological definition of the trade phrase, "pull it," as related to buildings. Given that context, I then played yet another brilliantly composed monologue by James Corbett in the form of a 9/11 conspiracy theory. That clip was then followed by a sample pertaining to the role of science and epistemology in discovering knowledge, as found in the documentary Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, Experts Speak Out, which I'll be playing in its entirety later on in this episode. Appropriately enough, we then heard Christine Todd Whitman state,
on behalf of the Environmental Protection Agency that the air at Ground Zero was safe to breathe. Next, I played a CBS News report from September 7th, 2011, informing us that a recent study finds a rise in Ground Zero-related cancers, specifically in first responders. Alex Jones and Paul Watson then broke down the news that the first responders are banned from today's Ground Zero ceremonies commemorating the 10th anniversary of 9/11 and their heroic actions. I then thought it would be appropriate to share the message of David Miller, a first responder dying of cancer in 2005, and to leave the audio as it is so that you can actually hear his respirator as he struggles to be heard. I then played another clip from the AE 9/11 Experts Speak Out documentary pertaining specifically to the role of fear and denial in the social paradigm and why the general public can't adapt their worldview to reality. Last but not least, I featured the audio from a video created by We Are Change featuring Bob McElvain, whose son was killed on 9/11, with Luke Radowski confronting the 9/11 Commission Chairman Thomas Kane, inquiring why the commission used an outline created in advance of the actual investigation written by Philip Zelikow instead of actually investigating the crimes of that day. Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of everyday life and relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast in higher education. Thank you for making time in your busy schedule to tune in and grow in the light direction. Peace Revolution and all the educational media we create here at TragedyandHope.com is presented as a public service without corporate sponsorship and is published commercial free and presented free to the public. Thanks to the generosity of the subscribers to the Tragedy and Hope online community and the hard work of the media hosts featured at TragedyandHope.com. I encourage you to check out the episode notes, the references, and the links for this and all episodes we publish at PeaceRevolution.org. I also invite you to click the invitation link in the episode notes and participate in the Tragedy and Hope online community and learn how to become a producer of solutions in a world full of problems. Thanks to the recent donations, we're within a few hundred dollars of finishing up production on The Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, which is our new multi-DVD interview project currently in its 10th week of post-production. I'm waiting on Blu-ray cases to arrive, and then we'll start testing the final project before making everyone's discs. And they're all being made right here at my desk, so I can be sure that you're receiving something very much worth your investment. If you'd like to donate and help us get this project out to the public and continue producing media of the highest quality without subjecting you and your precious time to boisterous advertisements, then please use any of the donation links on TragedyandHope.com or PeaceRevolution.org. With over 5 hours of interview footage, this is a collection of historical epiphanies relevant to everyone, and it's the perfect piece of media to break on through to the other side with those who don't yet have enough contextual information to connect the dots. Those who donate $50 or more toward the completion of this project will receive the entire DVD set or Blu-ray disc as our way of saying thanks, because without these donations, this project would not have been possible. In coming weeks, the Gatto DVD set will be available at a variety of sites, including JohnTaylorGatto.com, as well as Peace Revolution's partner podcast sites, including Media Monarchy, Corbett Report, Gnostic Media, The School Sucks Podcast, and Remedy Radio. We'll be using this project as a fundraiser, so all partners and affiliates will get to keep a generous percentage of each sale that they make on their sites to help embolden their respective independent media projects. Now, down to the business of 9/11. This being the 10th anniversary of America's most notorious set of crimes, which led into 10 years of war, without aim, ongoing. Starting with this episode, if you haven't already, you might consider getting organized and getting prepared to begin taking some detailed notes. What we've studied in the past 38 episodes is a trail of historical significance not yet offered in any university, and the quality of information can only lead you to a wealth of mind and serenity of life if you take the time and invest the effort to understand what's actually being pointed out along the way. The fact is, you can only keep so many things in your short-term memory at any given time. And if we don't all learn to start to write it down and keep organized records of our research, we'll still be lost 10 years from now. Beyond a notebook or a Word document or whatever you'd like to use to organize your notes, you can also visit thebrain.com and download the Personal Brain, which is the mind mapping software we use to organize and make the copious amounts of data that we're all sifting through useful now and in the future. There's a free version of the brain which does everything you need, including letting you share your models with others, which is why we find it so useful. This entire curriculum of human nature, everything that we've listed through the past 38 episodes, is a process of introducing and connecting dots. The past is prologue. And if you're looking for facts about 9/11, it needs to be made clear that knowledge is a map to that which exists. Now, notice how I used a metaphor to illustrate, as knowledge is not a literal map, but in understanding to that which I'm referring through the abstraction of thought, we find that what can't be said in words actually can be said in words. This leads us to the point where we need a theory of knowledge. A theory of knowledge is called epistemology, and if that word is new to you, this would be a great point to start your notes. Epistemology, meaning knowledge or science from the Greek word episteme, and logos, meaning study of, is a branch of philosophy concerned with the nature and scope or limitations of knowledge. It addresses the questions, what is knowledge? How is knowledge acquired? How do we know what we know? Much of the debate in this field has focused on analyzing the nature of knowledge and how it relates to connected notions such as truth, belief, and justification. It also deals with the means of production of knowledge, as well as skepticism about different knowledge claims. Now, to draw an example from our mass media culture, the 1991 film Backdraft, in which Robert De Niro plays a forensic investigator, can be used as a metaphor to illustrate how epistemology, or a theory of knowledge, is necessary in order to solve crimes, like 9/11. The essence of the film, without spoiling it for you, is that those who, quote, define the alleged knowledge regarding any situation are those who are also most adept and able to conceal the truth from the public. In other words, those who bring us the news of quote-unquote terrorism, those who provide the quote-unquote terrorism insurance, those who profit from the quote-unquote anti-terrorist legislation, and even the people writing the alleged anti-terrorist legislation are those who are actually defining the events for history. If you let them define the world for you, if you don't have a method to identify that which exists, then they are in control of what's believed, and their version of history stands uncontested as fact. We are a nation of CSI and NCIS viewers, yet in real life, the general public can't recognize a crime, let alone solve one. So how did this come to be? Epistemology, or lack thereof. If you don't have a method of defining reality, someone else is going to step in and define it for you. And if the ruling elite are defining your reality, you'll soon discover that they've defined all of us as slaves. You see, if you can't define that which exists, then you can't discern between that which exists and that which does not exist. Consider that for a moment. If you don't have a method of dispelling confusion by dismissing the arbitrary and removing contradictions, how clear is your thinking? If your survival depends on your ability to be self-reliant, how could you possibly be ensuring your survival by letting someone else arbitrarily define your reality and make decisions on your behalf? If you can't discern fact from fiction, or that which exists from that which does not exist, how do you know when the definers of reality are lying to you? It would seem that if we can't discern what exists, which is the essence of epistemology, it might be due to the fact that the very word epistemology is not to be found in the American public's vernacular. Now, if you recall from an earlier episode of this curriculum, Immanuel Kant's critique of pure reason, though rhetorically persuasive, in reality violates the laws of cause and effect, and therefore deny consequences, which is the exact recipe for a philosophic corruption of education, ensuring that students, who then grow up to be citizens, are left without the tools through which one identifies that which exists, and thereby uses reason to make informed choices. And if one doesn't have the methods by which to make informed choices, one does not have freedom, for freedom originates in the space between stimulus and response, where we pause and ask questions to see what is in our best interest. If we do not pause and ask questions, we are under the direct control of whomever or whatever is sending the stimuli to which we are responding. Thinking is the essence of freedom, and therefore, since thinking is the process of trying to identify that which exists and planning for survival, it is most interesting to note that it was the Prussian education system being imported to America which removed these critical tools of survival from our public school curriculum. If they had not, peace revolution would not be necessary. That being said, when Immanuel Kant died, he left his position at the University of Jena to Johann Fichte, who along with Georg Hegel and Johann Caspar Lavater, Johann Pestalozzi, and Wilhelm Wundt helped to spawn Kant's denial of cause and effect throughout American public school systems and, in fact, around the world. And ironically, all of these men played a role in the agenda of the Illuminati as laid out by Adam Weishaupt in 1776. To help me illustrate this point, here's a sample from hour 2 of my interview with John Taylor Gatto, in which he spells out how Wilhelm Wundt and the Prussian education system created a new elite society of so-called experts who hold PhDs. Experts who have been defining our reality and our world for over 150 years. And perhaps it's about time that we started defining our world for ourselves. And this is the essence of epistemology.
We have a series of these reinforcements of Darwinian theory, which is really a reinforcement of Anglican theology or Calvinist theology or Platonic philosophy or Fichtean philosophy, or if you want to go liberal, Spinozan philosophy, until finally we get to this cap. So now the cap is off the tunnel to hell, because not only are people justified in setting up a form of schooling that's anti-educational, but they're doing either nature's work or the Lord's work. You decide. You want to go Calvin, you're doing the Lord's work. You want to go nature, you go
Spinoza.
Yeah. Yeah. So that all of this wonderfully rich fabric of foundation is right on the surface. Someone has to point your attention to it. Please, no one watching say, oh, this fellow Gatto is spun off, you know, this phenomenal, interesting, but wacky theory. I didn't spin off anything. I took the dots and I connected them. And I said, they're identical from 300 BC until post-Darwin Galton comes a German, a Prussian psychophysicist named Wilhelm Wundt, who is the premier behavioral psychologist on Earth. And now let me spring a bombshell on all of you. The only place in the world for a long, long time you could get a PhD degree was either Prussia, University of Berlin, Leipzig, these little nests of Germanic countries. So from all over the world came the sons of the most powerful families, beginning in 1814 or 16 in the United States, when the guy who later became the governor of Massachusetts went over to get his PhD degree. By the 1870s, 1880s, was a flood from Japan, from Russia, from everywhere. And now they return to their home countries, not because they have a PhD degree or they made presidents of universities, heads of government bureaus, because their families have clout. And now that's become the ticket to intellectual management. That's how these Prussian ideas spread like wildfire. There's only one university in the United States who doesn't have a president with a Prussian PhD, and he's close. I think he has a French PhD, because the French scrambled to try to get that degree too. That's Titchener at Cornell, or the head of all the heads of psych departments, Prussian PhDs. So you now get this kernel of ideas, whether fanciful or scientific, everywhere. From Japan, I mean, everywhere the same idea. The Japanese Constitution in 1868 is scrapped, and the Prussian Constitution translated into Japanese. I mean, we're talking here the domination of ideas that's so interesting that what should make you suspicious is that no one ever heard of it. They heard of this detail. Why hasn't anyone joined them together? Well, I'll tell you what. A big shot professor at Columbia Teachers College told me 12 years ago when I bearded him in his den, and I said, Doug, surely you know these things. Why is a junior high school teacher left to beat the drum? He looked at me and he said, not a good way to get tenure. That's all he said, and I knew. That financial, finally, prize or penalty is enough to control the way we all think. And these things have been studied since the collegia in ancient Rome. Armies have put together these insights. Churches have put together these insights and passed them down in an unbroken string to their sons, usually, and of course the daughters catch as catch can, but eventually to both.
Coming full circle to address how all of this relates to 9/11, I would note that without a sense of epistemology, or a method to discern that which exists in tangible, objective reality, one cannot even begin to analyze the events of 9/11. And because that statement is so potent, let me take a few minutes and provide some specific examples in real-world reality. The 9/11 Commission Report, which is the official story of the events of 9/11, talks of hijackers and planes. And I don't deny either. Rather, my question is this. by what method did the 9/11 Commission validate this knowledge? I don't know. So, I have to try to validate it myself. And let me share what happens when I attempt to do so. Point 1. Examination of buildings which exploded on 9/11. My observation being that in New York, the North Tower of the World Trade Center, Tower 1, exploded on the floors occupied by Marsh & McLennan, the world's largest insurance brokerage. Tower 2, the South Tower, then exploded on the floors occupied by Fiduciary Trust, whose CEO, Ann Tatlock, was absent from the towers that morning as she was attending Warren Buffett's last annual golf tournament in Omaha, Nebraska. And now that I think of it, President Bush was also in Omaha, Nebraska later on 9/11. I digress, I'm sorry. The events in New York were then followed by an explosion at the Pentagon. These are the substantial and evident knowns of the situation without going beyond the evidence already proven to exist. From here, the question is asked, what is the most likely cause of an explosion or multiple explosions in buildings occupied by financial services, insurance companies, and government defense contractors, if not the government's defense outpost itself, the Pentagon? Point 2. Examination of the hijackers. My question being, if evidence of hijackers exists, where is it, and who has had custody of this evidence since 9/11? And who owned the equipment it was created on in the case of videos of the hijackers at the airports, or security tapes, or recordings of 9/11 calls from flights, etc.? What I found for myself was that in all of these so-called evidence instances, they all become highly suspicious and completely unbelievable if even the smallest amount of energy is invested into asking the questions who, what, when, where, why, and how. Now here's a specific example. Satan al-Sakami, an alleged hijacker, had his alleged passport found at Ground Zero in the rubble. This passport allegedly survived the explosion which destroyed the alleged plane and survived the destruction of the towers. Now here's the caveat. It was found by none other than Bernard Carrick, who was nominated later for Homeland Security Director, having been New York City's police commissioner, and during 9/11, he was Giuliani's right-hand man. Carrick, who was later charged for running a brothel at Ground Zero and was convicted and sentenced to prison for fraud, is not someone who I trust to provide evidence that he quote-unquote found at Ground Zero. Point 3. Examination of the planes. My question being, if evidence of planes exists, where is it, who has had custody of this evidence since 9/11, and who owned the equipment it was created on in the case of videos of planes hitting buildings, parts on the ground, etc.? I would note here that logic is the art of non-contradictory identification. That's a definition essential to learning a method of epistemology. So let me demonstrate how one might apply those ideas to this specific situation. The art of non-contradictory identification for commercial airliners consists of 6 points. 1. The tail number. This is painted on the tail of the plane. 2. Serial numbers on every one of the several million plane parts. 3. A transponder code on every commercial flight. 4. The black box on every commercial flight. 5. A radar signature monitored by air traffic control. 6. Blinking strobe navigation beacons introduced in the early 1970s and mandatory on every commercial flight. Given these 6 points of ascertaining a non-contradictory identification to validate the existence of even a single airliner, let's analyze and search for any one of the claimed hijacked planes to validate that we're not chasing down something arbitrary which should be dismissed. And I would note that if the identity of the commercial airliners hijacked on 9/11 is certain, then all 6 points of knowledge that I just mentioned will cross-reference. This is how a commercial airliner is identified in reality. However, on the morning of September 11th, 2001, all six of these points of identification fail. Point one, none of the alleged hijacked airliners were ever identified by their tail number, and no human being identified any of the alleged planes which hit any of the targets by tail number. And therefore, if there were in fact planes used to create the explosions in the buildings, then we cannot be certain of their identity in this manner. So let's move to point two. No serial numbers have been matched to any of the planes which were claimed to be hijacked, nor have any of the serial numbers ever been matched to any of the alleged wreckage attributed to be evidence at these scenes. Point three, the transponders were turned off in all flights. Point four, none of the black boxes were recovered and identified as matching any serial numbers or tail numbers associated with the 9/11 attacks. Point five, since there were numerous war games ongoing during the 9/11 attacks, air traffic controllers were seeing phantom radar blips representing fake planes, part of the war games, thus confusing them as to whether or not these were real world or exercise. And without a method to dispel this confusion, they were left blinded by the blinking lights on their screens. Point six, none of the alleged videos showing the alleged commercial airliners have blinking strobe navigation beacons on the wings or underneath the planes. Since these beacons were introduced in the 1970s and are mandatory on all commercial airliners, the question arises as to the authenticity of the videos and the nature of any objects captured on video and presented as Flights 11, 175, 77, and 93. Without identification, these objects on video are literally unidentified flying objects, yet to be identified. So the question is, who is telling us that these objects on video were in fact Flights 11, 175, 77, and 93? And by what method did they validate this information pertaining to the identity of the objects on video? Now, if we look at the examination of the buildings which allegedly collapsed from fire, we would note that both World Trade Center Towers 1 and 2 were composed of 47 steel columns which vertically run parallel and are connected together, forming the core of each building. Now, these massive columns, standing 1,300 feet tall, the height of each building, are part of a lattice work that's all interconnected. So the question is, if iron conducts heat, which it does, how much heat would one need to apply in order to heat up 47 huge columns of iron, each 1,300 feet long? And how long would that take? Because my point is that none of the steel near the explosion zone could have possibly heated up to the point of structural failure for the sheer fact that the heat would immediately spread out, as it tends to do, that's the nature of heat, into the lattice structure of iron girders and I-beams. This would mean that you would need fires much hotter, which would have to burn much longer, in order to even begin to get close to bridging the gap between the fiction of fire pulverizing concrete and reality. And anyone who examines the video of Ground Zero on the morning of 9/11 or listens to the testimony of the first responders can reasonably see that much of the mass of the buildings has been pulverized and is turned into dust, which then flows pyroclastically in giant clouds down the streets of New York. That cannot be explained by a simple building fire and structural failure. The next point I'd bring up would be the examination of the buildings, which fall at near free fall speed. And it seems upon reviewing the work of the authorities that the authors of the official story of 9/11 flunked high school physics and never looked back. In reality, we have pesky things like Newton's laws of falling bodies and cause and effect. You see, that stuff I said about Kant earlier was necessary to this episode and your understanding. as it's the negation of cause and effect, which is the signature of Kantian philosophy, that is the key to understanding who is behind such machinations as 9/11 and the ongoing war on terror. These are people who subscribe to a concept known as the noble lie. And in modern times, groups like the neoconservatives or neocons are propagators of the belief that they are justified sinners, and that lying to the public is just good business. The negation of cause and effect is, by definition, irrational, as it denies reality. Therefore, we're looking for those who subscribe to the philosophy of irrationality. And what we find are the people who created our public school system, which kind of explains why we can't communicate as a nation of individuals even 10 years after these events. But it doesn't have to continue to be this way. Overall, an examination of the investigation of 9/11, my observations would be, I would note that there were protocols broken, evidence was destroyed, witnesses were silenced, and that the 9/11 Commission's actions strike a familiar pattern to that which they claim to investigate regarding the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Furthermore, I'd like to again note for the record that the November 1998 edition of Foreign Affairs magazine, which is the mouthpiece for the Council on Foreign Relations, published two articles pointing toward 9/11 3 years before the event. Bernard Lewis's License to Kill, Osama bin Laden's Declaration of Jihad, on page 14. I've linked this article in the episode notes, but the point is, the reference to justified sinning is found in the purported License to Kill. When people have a license to kill, it's because they have some belief system that justifies that. Bernard Lewis also has that same justification. If you do a search on Bernard Lewis plus Tarpley, that would yield Webster Tarpley's presentation on how Bernard Lewis has been an agent of British intelligence and has long had plans on dividing and conquering the Middle East to redraw the maps of Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and many other nations. In this same 1998 Foreign Affairs edition, on page 80, we have an article titled Catastrophic Terrorism, Tackling the New Danger, by Ashton Carter, John Deutsch, and Philip Zelikow. Ashton Carter is Ford Foundation professor and currently with the Obama administration. John Deutsch is out of MIT and former director of Central Intelligence, also connected to the insider trading, where the stocks of Marsh & McLennan and American Airlines were shorted by the bank which employed Deutsch, and Philip Zelikow, former member of the National Security Staff and executive director of the 9/11 Commission 3 years later. In this article on catastrophic terrorism, also linked in the episode notes, we find phrases like weapons of mass destruction, World Trade Center, and a sentence that reads, like Pearl Harbor, this event would divide our past and future into a before and after. The United States might respond with draconian measures, scaling back civil liberties, allowing wider surveillance of citizens, detention of suspects, and use of deadly force. More violence could follow, either further terrorist attacks or U.S. counterattacks. Interesting, 3 years before 9/11, that this single issue of Foreign Affairs would point to a future attack on a World Trade Center, weapons of mass destruction, and everything that followed in the 10 years after 9/11, and it also points to the alleged perpetrator, the mastermind of the events himself, Osama bin Laden. However, when you do the grammar or examine the epistemology of who is Bernard Lewis and what is his life's work, and who is Philip Zelikow and what is his life's work been, their roles in supporting the propagandized view comes clearly into focus. Ironically enough, the article on catastrophic terrorism linked in the episode notes is published by the John F. Kennedy School of Government, which ironically enough supports Philip Zelikow. I would note here that Alan Dulles is to the JFK assassination cover-up what Philip Zelikow is to the 9/11 cover-up. Both Dulles and Zelikow were entrusted with leading the commission toward their respective truths, which are evidently in both cases psychological operations of warfare involving the mass proliferation of snuff film footage to create trauma, which leads to the irrationality of war for profit. Continuing on that line of thought, in a few minutes, I'll be featuring two more pieces of powerfully illustrative media for your consideration of all things 9/11. The first being a 15-minute sample of the 2005 feature film titled Who Killed John O'Neill, which I mentioned during my 2006 Project Constellation audio message, wherein I attempted to connect the dots and describe the big picture. Who Killed John O'Neill, or WKJO as it's better known, was created by Ty Rober and Ryan Thurston and features some of the most brilliantly scripted dialogue delving into the questions and evidence surrounding 9/11. As the feature presentation of this episode, it's my pleasure to present 2 hours of testimony featuring engineers and architects, people whose profession it is to know the facts about physics and use the scientific method to identify knowledge. The film is titled AE 9/11 Experts Speak Out, and it's available at ae911truth.net on DVD, and after reviewing it yesterday and rearranging this entire episode, I trust that after you listen, take notes, and discuss with other people who think for themselves, you'll remember that this was the September 11th when the tide turned and everything started to make sense once again, only this time our reality will be based in reality. But before I play those two fascinating samples, I'd like to yield the floor once again to James Corbett, who has some important information about the recent archive release of 9/11 audio tapes. As you'll soon hear, conspiracy is no longer a theory, and this is a step toward resolving the cognitive dissonance which has resonated without disturbance for 10 years. This is episode 39, 9/11 Backdraft, examining the crimes 10 years later. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
Audio tapes released from 9/11 archives, majority of records still sealed. This is Behind the Headlines from grtv.ca. As the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks approaches, the National Archives has released a compilation of audio clips of air traffic controllers, military officers, and pilots recorded that morning. The release was organized by former 9/11 Commission investigator Miles Cara, who reviewed and transcribed the documents with help from Rutgers Law School director and former 9/11 Commission senior counsel John Farmer. The clips were originally organized by Commission members for a report on the air response that day, but was not completed before the commission wrapped up in 2004 because they were unable to gain the necessary declassifications for the recordings in time. The tapes are being heralded for the stark insight they provide into the chaotic response to the 9/11 attacks.
What? What was that?
Not real world. Real world.
Although many of the recordings have been heard before, the recent release purports to compile the key conversations into a single, chilling narrative of what unfolded over American airspace that day. Rather than bringing closure, however, the tapes merely highlight some of the still unresolved issues of the 9/11 air response. This includes the inexplicable decision to scramble fighters from Langley Air Force Base, not toward the nation's capital where American Flight 77 was already approaching the Pentagon, but out over the Atlantic Ocean, toward a military training airspace known as Whiskey 386. This recording, taken at 9:39, captures the moment when Needs Mission Crew Commander Kevin Nisipany learns for the first time that the fighters have been scrambled in the wrong direction.
Okay, we're fucking super to go there. You need to be. I don't care how many windows you break.
Finally, I'm with you.
Yes, sir. 386. Why'd they go out there?
Because the guy pushed out of
there. God damn it. Okay, push it back.
Equally puzzling is the 12-minute gap between the time American Flight 11 stopped responding to commands and the time when air traffic controllers began notifying the chain of command that the plane had been hijacked. At that point, the plane had been wildly off course for 5 minutes, and the plane's transponder had been off for a full 4 minutes.
This is Adam.
This is Boston. I turned American 20 left and I was going to climb him. He will not respond to me now.
At all. Looks like he's turning right.
Yeah, I turned him 20 right.
Oh, okay.
And he's only going to I think 29.
Okay.
Low.
Sure, that's fine.
But
you want to answer to him. He's Nardo. Roger.
All right.
Thanks.
This delayed response is in fact so suspicious that in December of 2006, experienced Boston Center air traffic controller Robin Horden went public with his assertion that 9/11 was an inside job. Calling the focus on the confusion and panic in the tapes distractionary, Horden said at the time, "The real focus is what the air traffic controller did immediately upon seeing that American 11 was in trouble, and what we do as air traffic controllers is we get eyes and ears on this flight. If the air traffic controller were going by emergency procedures, which he is trained to do, he would have reached out directly to ADC and say, what do you see?" What this release of audio tapes obscures is the fact that recorded testimony of six of the air traffic controllers involved in directing the air traffic that day, testimony that could have potentially resolved many of the outstanding questions about the air response, was destroyed by an FAA manager before anyone had a chance to describe what was said or even listen to the tapes. According to information that surfaced in 2004, the manager destroyed the recording by crushing the tape with his hand, cutting it into small pieces, and depositing the pieces into trash cans around the building. Hidden in the shadow of the press coverage devoted to this release of material from the National Archives, much of which was previously available to the public, is the stark fact that even now, 2 years after the National Archive was slated to make the 9/11 Commission's records open to the public, more than two-thirds of that information is still being kept sealed. Of the 575 cubic feet of records held by the archive, so far only 150 cubic feet of textual records has been released, and even amongst that, a significant amount of material has been redacted. The commission itself had asked the archives to unseal their records in January of 2009, but after initially releasing the commission's memoranda for the record, the archives have stopped releasing further material. Since the commission was set up as part of the legislative branch of government, its records are exempt from Freedom of Information requests. Only one archive official now works on the 9/11 Commission document archive, and a Reuters report indicates that she usually refers applicants to the agencies that created the documents, rather than respond to requests for information herself. The information still held by the commission includes details of the commission's meeting with President Bush and Vice President Cheney, which they insisted in doing behind closed doors, off the record, and without being sworn under oath. To this date, that meeting remains the only time the two have ever been formally questioned about the events of the single most important day in modern American history. This has been a news update from Global Research TV. For the latest news and information from around the world, please go to globalresearch.ca.
If we are going to do anything, we all have to be clear on every single detail on this wall. Okay? Okay?
Okay.
Okay. Let's begin. Have you ever heard of a company called Kroll Associates?
The name sounds familiar.
Oh, I guarantee you have seen Kroll on television. They are champions of counterterrorism.
This is where the counterterrorists come in?
Maybe they didn't run the PSYOP, but they sure as hell did cover it up. My friend, Kroll was bigger than you could possibly imagine. Kroll Associates is a global securities and intelligence firm. Publicly traded and privately managed, Kroll specializes in large building security and industrial espionage. In 1993, Kroll got a contract to manage security at the World Trade Center. They held that position up until the moment the towers fell. The current CEO of Kroll is Michael Tracasky.
Tracasky is a former assistant district attorney under Robert Morgenthau in Manhattan.
The former employees of Kroll include people like William Bratton, a former police commissioner in Boston and New York City, and now chief of the LAPD. And then, of course, there's Brian Jenkins.
Based out of Los Angeles, Jenkins is the country's foremost expert on aviation terrorism.
Now working for the powerful think tank, the RAND Corporation, out of Los Angeles, Jenkins is a noted counterterrorism pundit and appears on many talk shows and news magazines.
And lest we forget, Jerome Hauer.
J. Jerome Howard, the go-to guy for bioterrorism. In an investigation of 9/11, Howard's name comes up more than anybody else's. As a managing director of Kroll in New York City, Howard was responsible for doing security at the World Trade Center. Jerome Howard is also the guy that got John O'Neill his job as head security at the World Trade Center. Yes, he did. Just prior to this, Jerome Howard was Rudy Giuliani's right-hand man in New York, where he headed up the Office of Emergency Management, OEM, FEMA, in New York City. And it was by Jerome Howard's suggestion that Mayor Giuliani constructed what became known as the Federal Bunker Offices in World Trade Center Building Number 7. Fireproof, bombproof, bulletproof, these OEM offices were basically Giuliani's headquarters in New York City. Until WTC 7 collapsed on 9/11.
That is incredible.
Besides just these jobs, Howard has been the number one bioterrorism expert in the whole world. He is a well-known advisor to the Council on Foreign Relations, formerly worked for the National Institute of Health, and is currently the head of the Office of Public Health Preparedness. And on the morning of 9/11, just as the attacks were happening, Howard instructed the entire White House staff to go on Cipro, the anti-anthrax drug. Now, how did he know anthrax was going to become an issue? Well, as fate would have it, Howard worked in 1999 with Stephen Hatfield, the prime suspect in the anthrax attacks at the Scientific Applications International Corporation, the SAIC. This company, the SAIC, was awarded a huge biodefense contract after 9/11. Hatfield, a well-known friend of Jerome Howard, was working on the military-grade anthrax program at U.S. AMRID, Fort Detrick, Maryland. And Battelle. Don't forget Battelle. A chemicals company with long-standing ties to the CIA. Howard was well aware of the U.S. AMRID project in Maryland.
So is Howard CIA?
Kroll is CIA! Come on! We don't know that. Oh, yes, we do. Yes, we do. I mean, their intelligence is not just going to come right out and say it. But you know what they do. You know what they do. Oh, you know it. They are private intelligence! A managing director there has said, quote, Kroll is like a private CIA. He knows what's going on. He knows what's going on. And there are other companies like Kroll as well. There's TNM Protection, run by Robert Tucker. Tucker? Tucker met with O'Neill and Howard the night before 9/11! They had drinks at Lane's. There's Strang Hayes Consulting. There's Wackenhut Corporation. Then there's CTC International. The Cohen Group. And then there's Stratesic, formerly called Securicom. Stratesic also had a contract to do security at the World Trade Center. Securicom also had security contracts with Dulles International Airport and United Airlines. And remember, United had two planes crash on 9/11. And one of those planes came from Dulles. Now, an interesting note about Securicom is that from 1993 to 2000, one of its principal shareholders was a man by the name of...
Marvin Bush.
The president's younger brother.
That's an interesting connection.
But not necessarily indicative of anything. It's 6 degrees of separation.
Bush's younger brother doing security in the World Trade Center is something that needs to be seriously investigated!
By that rationale, we could have known a guy who knew a guy who worked with a guy who stood in the same street corner as Jerome Howard, and therefore we're guilty. We are saying it's guilt by association. Which maybe we shouldn't do.
You can't discount Kroll's connection to all of this!
No, I can't. And I won't. Now, Kroll has been involved in a host of shady operations. In 1991, the Kuwaiti government hired Kroll to investigate Saddam Hussein's finances. In 2002, Kroll was given the massive responsibility of reorganizing Enron.
Through 97 and 98, Kroll oversaw the elections of the Teamsters Union.
And just following 9/11, Kroll was tapped by the LAPD to monitor all counterterrorism efforts in Los Angeles. Kroll really gets around. Kroll is tied to the FBI as well. The director of the FBI during Waco and the first World Trade Center bombing was a man by the name of William Sessions. Now, when he left the Bureau, he became a shareholder of Kroll. And the next FBI director was Louis Free. And Louis Free's top advisor at the Bureau was a guy named James Buckham. Guess where he works now? He's a managing director of Kroll. Free is now a senior vice president at the MBNA Credit Card Corporation. His specific duties include personnel and security. Next to Enron, MBNA was the largest campaign contributor to George W. Bush in 2000. One of Free's deputy directors was James K. Carlstrom, with a K. At the time of 9/11, Carlstrom was head of New York State's Office of Public Security. And he also works at MBNA with Louis Free. And both Free and Carlstrom are well-known friends of Jerome Hauer. Now, it has been rumored that MBNA was one of the companies heavily involved in pre-9/11 insider trading, which would have been investigated by the SEC in New York City, but all those records went down
in World Trade Center 7.
You want to know what really gets me? I'll tell you what really gets me. How all these guys, how Tchaikovsky and Jenkins and Bratton and Hauer, just how the hell did they become terrorism pundits, huh? I mean, they drop themselves out on TV all the goddamn time and say, Al-Qaeda this, and terrorists read that, and follow our research, and blah, blah, blah. Just where the hell did they get all their information? I hate to say it, but he's right. They aren't official law enforcement or intelligence, yet somehow they became the foremost experts on counterterrorism. A lot of them are former law enforcement. But terrorism is one of the most closely guarded fields of all intelligence. Why would you leak information just to a couple of buddies and allow them to trump all that information on a national television, To build up the propaganda campaign, obviously. To frame up Al-Qaeda before and after the fact. Look. We've all got to understand that a company like Kroll, even though it won't disclose its intelligence ties, it's intimately linked to the CIA. But if we're saying that the CIA runs domestic terrorism operations, we are saying Kroll does as well. These people have so much information about terrorism because they're either deeply rooted to intelligence, or they are intelligence, privatized, in order to make their work legal and untouchable by Congress.
Oh God, are we saying that the people who run counterterrorism
may very well be the terrorists themselves? Look, it's no coincidence that Kroll did security at those buildings. And it's no secret that Kroll employees have more inside knowledge about terrorism than even the FBI and the CIA do. They are inexplicably in a position to get inside information, even from people like John O'Neill. Then they come out and they warn the country, or they tell everybody how the whole terrorist outfit works. They are well-placed operatives working a specific agenda to frame the patsies. And what do they say? To frame someone, you have to know the real details of the crime? Kroll is our suspect number one. No one had more means, motive, or opportunity to commit this attack. You can't be serious. What you're saying is suicide. You do not go out and publicly accuse a company like Kroll Associates of being a publicly traded terrorism company, okay? These people profit from insider knowledge of coming terrorist attacks. They don't disclose their credentials or their contacts. They merely claim they are experts from Kroll, and that's supposed to mean they are trustworthy. We need to stick to what we can prove here. All of this is just blatant speculation and can discredit this entire thing. Unless it's true. This is not how you run an investigation. You do not just dream up a hypothesis and then change the evidence to make it come true.
you follow your leads.
Which led to Kroll!
But not to this wild theory. I'm sure that these counter-terrorists are involved somehow. But there is no proof whatsoever that they took part in any of the attacks or even had any foreknowledge. So does that mean we just forget about it? Move on to the next topic? No. It means we don't get sidetracked. We can't just go flapping our lips about any old theory that we want to.
So then how does Kroll get their information? How do these guys, of all people, know information that even our paid law enforcement and intelligence officials don't know? I mean, how does one become a terrorism expert anyway?
You already have your answer. Former FBI directors on their board, former biowarfare experts within their infrastructure, members of major think tanks as directors, former U.S. attorneys as executives. This company is filled with people who could have had prior knowledge and just kept their contacts secret. This is a security company, after all. And one of the most important security issues facing the world in the last 20 years has been security from terrorism. That's where they get all their information. That is how they become counterterrorism experts. He has a point. There is clearly something wrong with Kroll, but we can't jump to conclusions.
So then where do you think Kroll fits into this whole thing?
They're just a group of for-hire thugs. They come in and trump up the charges on whoever needs to be guilty, and then they fade back into the shadows. The only thing I see them being guilty of is misleading the public. And the purpose of that? Maybe you're right. Maybe it is to cover up their crime. Or maybe, and so that people will hire them to secure their buildings. Maybe they take advantage of 9/11 the same way that Bush does. They take advantage of 9/11 for profit.
Tribute lights in the New York skyline, an annual memorial to the lives lost on 9/11. Yet there's still more light that needs to shine, revealing truths that their family members deserve to know. September 11th, 2001, a day that changed history. Four planes went silent and off course. Two of those planes crashed into the World Trade Center Twin Towers. Several columns were severed, and the jet fuel ignited fires that spread over several floors. About an hour later, millions watched in shock as both towers were suddenly and rapidly destroyed, killing almost 3,000 people, for whom truth and justice may have yet to be served. Hi, I'm Richard Gage, AIA. Licensed architect of over 20 years and member of the American Institute of Architects. I'm founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, a nonprofit organization of well over 1,000 technical and building professionals. According to official government reports, the fires weakened the structural steel framing of both twin towers, leading to sudden, progressive, and total collapses. Unknown to most people, a third steel frame high-rise, World Trade Center 7, was also destroyed. Critical questions have been raised by more than 1,500 architects and engineers about the official explanations for the destruction of all three of these buildings. Along with more than 10,000 other concerned individuals, these professionals, collectively comprising more than 25,000 years of experience, have signed our petition. They're calling for a new investigation into the destruction of these three World Trade Center high-rises. This call is based on evidence that reveals a very different destruction scenario than reported by government engineers. This includes abundant scientific forensic data and eyewitness testimony that was omitted from the official reports. You'll be seeing this evidence and hearing from dozens of these technical experts, including many who are among the top in their respective fields. We at AE 9/11 Truth are inspired by President Obama's affirmation to the American people in his inaugural address. How do we accomplish this? We've done our best to fulfill the President's vision by using the scientific method, examining the evidence from the World Trade Center and developing unbiased conclusions from unbiased experts in their fields. Listen to the President provide his account of the pervasive political abuse of science.
And we have watched as scientific integrity has been undermined and scientific research politicized in an effort to advance predetermined ideological agendas.
As coherent sets of scientific facts are brought into focus by the experts, the data, and the witnesses in this film, you'll come to a much greater understanding of the events of 9/11 and will be in a position to draw your own informed conclusions. Also, psychologists, therapists, and counselors, along with theologian David Ray Griffin, who have a deep understanding of the personal issues associated with 9/11, will explain why it is so difficult for us to come to terms with the reality of these events and learn how we can help ourselves and others with this difficult yet vital responsibility. Of course, the ones still most affected by the events of that tragic day are the family members of the victims lost on 9/11. Several have asked to appear in this documentary. Although our focus will be primarily technical, we are deeply moved and honored to give them the opportunity to speak directly to you. Now, let's hear from the AE 9/11 Truth professional petition signers, who will share with you what conclusions they came to. Among these experts are high-rise architects and engineers in the fields of structural design, material science, chemistry, fire protection, metallurgy, as well as physicists, explosives experts, and demolition technicians. Joining them will be firefighters and 9/11 victims' family members who support our call for a new World Trade Center investigation. Now, let's hear from the AE 9/11 Truth professional petition signers who will share with you what conclusions they came to. Among these experts are high-rise architects and engineers in the fields of structural design, material science, chemistry, fire protection, metallurgy, as well as physicists, explosives experts, and demolition technicians. Joining them will be firefighters who support our call for a new World Trade Center investigation.
I don't want to be involved in conspiracy theories. There are lots of them. They can go on. We can speculate on that forever. What we really need to know is how those buildings came down.
My name is Joel Miller, and I have a Bachelor of Architecture degree from Temple University in Philadelphia. And while I was there in Philadelphia, I worked for two firms on a couple of high-rise buildings. The 13-story Federal Detention Center for Ewing Cole, Cherry, and Broad. I spent about 2 years on that project, and then a year on a high-rise dormitory, about 15 stories for MGA Partners. If we are to believe that fire brought down three buildings on the same day on 9/11, that's very troubling for all of us in the design professions, architects, engineers, even physicists. I'm incredulous that this could have happened and very troubled by the implications of this possibility. There are thousands of high-rise buildings in the United States and more being built every day in this country and abroad. As architects and engineers, we have a responsibility to protect people that are users of buildings.
World Trade Center Building 7 looms above the site of its original. Building 7 was a 47-story high-rise, not hit by an airplane. Yet, it was the third modern steel-frame skyscraper to collapse rapidly and symmetrically on 9/11. It was a football field away from the North Tower and sustained minor damage from the falling debris. Building 7's precipitous collapse was blamed on normal office fires.
I'm Kamal Obaid. I have a master's degree in civil and structural engineering from the University of California at Berkeley. I've been a practicing engineer for the last 30 years. Building 7 to me is really what gives it away, because that's a classic case of controlled demolition.
My name is Stephen Dusterwald. I'm a licensed professional structural engineer with 37 years of experience in the structural field. I have 25 years of experience as owner and principal of my own structural engineering firm here in Las Vegas. I have focused on nuclear power plant design, large commercial and industrial buildings. I first became aware of the problems with the official account of the collapse when I saw a DVD online from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. They pointed out various problems with the official story, and the ones that caught my attention were the rapid failure of the connections in order for the building to come down at the rate that it did.
My name is Casey Pfeiffer. I am a registered professional structural engineer in San Diego, California. I have a Bachelor of Science degree in civil engineering at the University of Notre Dame. I have been practicing engineering for 15 years, and currently I am the principal of Pacific Coast Structural Engineering in San Diego, California. A friend of mine gave me a blueprint for 9/11 Truth DVD to review, and from that, the evidence that I saw was so compelling that it became obvious that the official story was not correct.
I'm William Bryce. I work for one of the nation's largest design build construction firms on commercial and industrial and institutional projects in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore areas. As a professor, taught engineering materials, structures lab, and other building-related courses at Vermont Technical College to architectural and engineering students for 20 years. I watched Building 7 fall at an accelerating rate in 6.5 seconds. This was a massive 47-story structure. The only way that a building can accelerate as it collapses is by having pre-engineered, precisely timed and precisely placed explosives, in other words, controlled demolition.
My name is David Topete. I have a Master's of Science degree in civil engineering. I am a licensed structural engineer. I design new structures and retrofit existing structures from concrete or masonry or structural steel. In my professional opinion, in my experience, for World Trade Center 7 to collapse straight down upon itself, as the video indicates, as everything that we've witnessed, the supports at the center essentially all had to be taken out at once. I certainly believe that it had to have been controlled demolition, controlled charges, explosives, something of that type, because it was a sudden failure.
I'm Dr. Bob Bowman, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Air Force, retired. Flew 101 combat missions in Vietnam, directed all the Star Wars programs under Presidents Ford and Carter. My PhD is in aeronautics and nuclear engineering from Caltech. I did postdoctoral work at the von Karman Institute in Brussels, Belgium, in finite element analysis. I taught at 5 universities and colleges, serving as department head and assistant dean. The coup de grace for me was when I found out that Building 7 had collapsed later that day, and when I saw Building 7 come down. To me, Building 7, the fact that it looks like a perfect controlled demolition of an intact building with no visible fires, I mean, that's what I call a smoking gun.
My name is Robert McCoy. I'm an architect, a Bachelor of Architecture from the University of California in Berkeley in 1963. Been licensed in California since about 1964. From about 1965 until about 1985, most of my experience has been in high-rise, multi-story steel buildings. NIST would have us to believe that these were was a typical office fire, scattered office fires, if you will, that brought this building down. Since the mid-60s, I've tried to follow high-rise fires because they're something we worry a lot about as we design these buildings. And I'm not aware of any high-rise building that have come down as a result of fires. I can't remember even a partial collapse in any of these buildings that I've watched over the years.
I'm Steve Barish, founder and president of Barish Architects and Associates, Inc., a 33-year-old architecture planning and engineering firm. We have offices in San Luis Obispo and Pasadena, California. I hold a Bachelor of Architecture degree from the University of Arizona and a Master's of Architecture in Urban Design from Rice University in Houston, Texas. Spent 3 years in London as the first PhD student at the Architectural Association. One of the things that really interested me is how quickly the Tower 7 fell. It fell within 7 seconds approximately from top to bottom. This building was built in the mid-80s apparently and met all the known codes at the time. Buildings just don't behave like that.
We're here in Sydney with Jan Utzon, son of the great Jorn Utzon, who designed the Sydney Opera House. What are the features of the collapse of World Trade Center 7 that caused you to be disturbed?
It looked like it was a demolition more than anything else.
My name is Les Young. I'm a licensed architect in both New York State and in California. I've been involved in many large projects, including overseeing several high-rise buildings ranging in size from 14 stories to 40. Over the course of 20 years, I'm mainly called in to help with very large, difficult projects. When I watched Building 7 collapse, it basically left no doubt in my mind that something was wrong. Building 7 had not been hit by a plane. To me, it was obvious that there was some controlled demolition and some explosions involved.
Was the structural steel from World Trade Center 7 preserved, documented, analyzed according to standard procedures for investigating engineering failures?
It was really clear from the beginning that there was this great move to, as quickly as possible, get rid of all of the rubble and move it off.
Because what they did immediately after 9/11 was they started removing the steel, the debris from Tower 7 and all the towers immediately. They sent it off to China to be recycled.
400 truckloads per day of material were taken away from the World Trade Center site and sent to China for recycling.
All of a sudden they had a big incentive to recycle steel for some reason.
Quickly and rapidly they were destroying the structural steel.
The steel was hauled away and melted down before it could be analyzed.
It was already being carted away and destroyed when the FEMA investigators got there about a month after September 11th.
It was being melted down, it was being cut up into pieces so that no real thorough investigation could happen. And that in itself is a crime, and that kind of thing needs to be investigated.
The steel was picked up and carted away before anybody got a good look at it. And the destruction of evidence was a criminal act in itself. It would have answered a lot of questions that we can't answer because we don't have the structural steel to examine.
There were laws violated in the destruction of that evidence. And for the American Society of Civil Engineers to ignore those events is extremely disturbing. And is a violation, in my opinion, of their professional code of ethics.
It was contrary to the way all investigations are done. If an airplane crashes, they seal off the entire area and nobody touches anything. They move it to a secure location and they reconstruct an aircraft.
Normally, when you have a structural failure, you carefully go through the debris field, looking at each item, photographing every beam as it collapsed and every column where it is in the ground, and you pick them up very carefully and you look at each element. We were unable to do that in the case of Tower 7.
Aside from this one small piece that was found to have intergranular melting, incredibly, none of the other steel from World Trade Center 7 was saved for analysis. This is disconcerting, considering World Trade Center 7 would have been the first steel frame high-rise building in history to ostensibly collapse due to fire.
The government has destroyed much of the evidence, but there's still some evidence available in photographs of the evidence.
My name is Lynn Margulis. I've been doing science every day since I was about 16 years old. I teach at the University of Massachusetts. I have a PhD in genetics. I reconstruct the past natural history from clues taken to be representational, and that's exactly what we're doing with reconstructing of why the buildings were destroyed in 9/11. In the historical science, that's what must be done. In 1999, I was a recipient of the President's Medal of Science from Clinton, and I received the Da Vinci Award, that is the membership in the Da Vinci Society. You can't do science when you are deprived of the evidence and when your hypothesis is the least valid instead of the most likely. When the most likely hypothesis in the case of Building 7 wasn't even mentioned, this is not science. So the claim is that it's something else. It's trying to prove preconceived ideas.
Was a proper investigation performed that might have revealed the use of accelerants or explosives in World Trade Center 7's destruction?
My name is Stephen Jones, a physicist. I received my PhD in physics from Vanderbilt University in 1978, so I've been at this for over 30 years, studying various subjects. I have published over 50 peer-reviewed papers in my career. NIST concedes that they found no evidence for explosives. So then we asked them, well, did you look? And they said, no, we did not look for explosives or residues of explosives.
I'm Ron Brookman, licensed structural engineer in California, and I received my master's degree in structural engineering from University of California at Davis in 1986. I've been practicing structural engineering ever since then. NIST never did a proper evaluation of the collapse site and the debris. World Trade Center 7, I would have expected they would have tested for explosives also, because of the nature of the collapse and the unprecedented nature of a steel-framed high-rise building collapsing in such a fashion.
My name is Roland Angle. I'm a civil engineer registered in the state of California. I've been practicing in California since 1967. I'm a graduate of the University of California. And my practice has included, among other things, design and testing of structures that were designed to withstand blasts. Specifically, for instance, the launch facilities for the Minuteman missile system. I was a Green Beret for 6 years during the 60s. I was trained in the use of demolitions, and I blew a lot of things up. One of the things that we did was go out and attack structures, analyze them as to where their weak points were, learn how to place explosives at points that would cause them to fail, and then actually demolish them and analyze our results. So the method of how to attack a structure and cause it to fail with explosives was one of the things that I learned through my military training. Well, the American Society of Civil Engineers was brought into this investigation early on. They did a very superficial investigation of the site. They issued a report without any significant forensic examination, and there were laws violated in the destruction of that evidence. And for the American Society of Civil Engineers to ignore those events is extremely disturbing and is a violation, in my opinion, of their professional code of ethics.
I'm Tony Zambodi. I'm a mechanical engineer from the Philadelphia area with over 20 years of experience in the aerospace industry, where I design structures for aircraft and spacecraft and support equipment. Neither NIST or FEMA followed standard protocol for fire and explosion investigations, or just fire investigations for that matter. National Fire Protection Association Guide Number 921 calls for saving the evidence and being prepared to justify why you wouldn't. It also calls for testing for accelerants and explosives when high-order damage is involved. NIST did not do this. NIST is often responsible for generating information which the NFPA guides are written from. It makes one wonder why the NFPA standard would not be followed in this case. NIST has not answered this question publicly.
There's national standards that need to be followed. And when I started looking into that, I went into the investigation manual. And so it's called the NFPA 921, and it's the fire and explosion. It's the guide for fire and explosions investigations. And so what it is, it's a national standard. So if an investigator from New York has to come out to the West Coast to help with something, they can fit right in seamlessly into the system and know where what their role is and what they need to be doing. And so I went and I got the manual from 2001, and I went back and I looked at the footage from the original day. There were all kinds of firefighters and civilians that were reporting explosions.
Okay, all right. Here, hold on. You want to call your mother or something?
Keep your eye on that building. It's coming down.
Just the fact that there were explosions means they need to be investigated. Terrorists used explosives in 93. We had witnesses to explosions. We have audio recording of explosions. We have overwhelming evidence that there were some explosive events. The manual gets into thermite, and if it says if you have melted steel or concrete, which we had on 9/11, and there's videos of it, people can see it, we should test for it. It says when you have melted steel or concrete, you test for thermite. So the fact that they're not testing for it is crazy. We had 3,000 Americans murdered, and we had the first three high-rise and steel collapses. We have all these reports of explosions. We have the vans pulled over. We have the history of terrorists using explosives. It's absolutely ridiculous that there's no excuse for it. It's criminal, in my opinion. It's absolutely criminal that they refuse to follow the national standards, and the national standards say that they should be testing that for explosives. One of the other big issues we have, the firefighters that are members of the Firefighters for 9/11 Truth, is just the blatant destruction of evidence. It's we're not talking about a little bit of evidence. They destroyed all the steel, basically the bones of the building that would have told us how this first high-rise steel structure in history that hadn't been struck by an airplane, all it had was a few fires on several floors, and it had only been burning for a few hours. We've had other high-rises burn much longer. This was the way we could have learned from this was analyzing that, looking at the steel and seeing how this collapsed and how it failed and which steel members did what. Well, we can't do that, because what they did immediately after 9/11 was they started removing the steel, the debris from Tower 7 and all the towers immediately. Why were they destroying this? I mean, they sent it off to China to be recycled. So they never had any physical evidence to do the investigation. The national standards are very clear. We have preservation of evidence. We have spoliation of evidence. There's all kinds of basically standards that you don't destroy evidence. So that's what we're calling for. We're calling for an investigation into the investigators, why they destroyed this. We're calling for a reinvestigation that follows national standards. And the big thing is everybody says this is in the past, leave it in the past, and that's not true. We have Ground Zero workers dying today. They're getting cancers. And several of them don't have medical insurance. The FDNY, most of them are being taken care of by the department, but there were so many thousands of volunteers and members of other departments that showed up, and they were there for months afterwards, and they don't have the medical coverage. They can't make their house payments. They're sick and dying, and we as a country are ignoring them. I mean, we promised we'd never forget. But it looks to me like most people have forgotten, and they want us to forget. And that's what we're here for, is to basically just ask people to take another look into this, you know, show some compassion, and let's help, you know, our brothers and sisters out and really reinvestigate 9/11. I mean, we have, it's changed our world. It's, you know, not to mention that there were 343 brothers murdered, but we're at war over this. We've lost a lot of our freedoms over this, and we don't have the real story on what happened because there wasn't a proper investigation done.
As reported by the New York Times, engineers were baffled by the collapse of Building 7. Since no steel frame high-rise has ever completely collapsed due to fire, how are we to understand this mysterious event?
My name is Scott Granger. I'm a licensed fire protection engineer. I'm licensed in 13 states. I've been in private practice for 25 years. I've been a practicing engineer for 39 years. 50% of my practice is in forensic engineering. Steel structural frame buildings, high-rise buildings, simply do not collapse due to fire. There has never been, until 9/11, an experience where a high-rise building that was steel frame completely collapsed. There have been fires burned longer in similar structures without any collapse.
In my previous career as a firefighter, normally you'd never be afraid to go into a type 1 building because they're not combustible and you would just charge at it and put the fire out. Never in my training were we ever taught that these type of buildings could just collapse in on themselves. There's definitely much more going on than just fire.
The way in which steel-framed buildings behave in fires depends on their construction. In this test, done by British Steel in 1995, a large amount of typical office furniture was burned to see what would happen to the heavy steel beams that supported the ceiling.
When steel is bare, when it heats up, it gets weaker. It's not that it melts in a fire. In fact, normal fires are not hot enough to melt steel. Even if you were, for example, to use an unusual fuel like kerosene, you cannot achieve temperatures hot enough to melt steel. But what happens is it starts to lose its strength. And as it loses its strength, it starts to sag. It becomes softer and sags and can no longer support the load.
This was the largest test of its kind ever conducted. It showed how unprotected steel can be distorted, even by a normal office fire. But as is typical in steel buildings, the structural beams only slowly and progressively warped and sagged. There was no chance of a sudden collapse.
In over 20 years, I have not seen, until recently, a protected steel structure that has collapsed in a fire.
The World Trade Center 7 building reminds me of the Meridian Bank building in some ways in Philadelphia. The Meridian Bank building is a 38-story skyscraper that burned for 18 hours in 1991, suffered extensive damage from the fire, but did not collapse.
I am Dan Barnum, FAIA, a graduate architect from Rice University with a Bachelor of Architecture degree. For the 40 plus years that I've been practicing architecture, I have designed a variety of buildings from small houses to high-rise office buildings. Some of the high-rises that I've worked on are one shell and two shell here in Houston, and I was project manager for a 22-story office building in Akron, Ohio. I'm a fellow of the American Institute of Architects. I've designed high-rise buildings and I know what they do in fires because I've studied that. Later in the day, when World Trade Center 7 collapsed, they had already showed us pictures of a few fires in that building, and I mean, they weren't even raging. And how could that cause a building to collapse as if it were imploded? Couldn't happen.
My name is Jonathan Smolens, PE. I'm a professional structural engineer in the Boulder, Denver area for the past 12 years. And one of my specialties is forensic engineering, including evaluation of structures post-disaster. What happened to those columns to all collapse at the same time? The explanation provided does not match the evidence that we have.
My name is Michael Donnelly, PE. I'm a structural engineer with 14 years of experience. I get involved mostly with the design of steel-framed fireproof buildings. We've never had a steel-framed skyscraper collapse in the United States or internationally. So there's no precedent. I don't think Building 7 could have collapsed by fire, as NIST tells us that this collapse mechanism, starting with thermal expansion that worked its way upward and outward through the building, in a matter of seconds, there's not enough time for the building to collapse the way that NIST tells us it collapsed.
I'm Ed Moniak, licensed fire protection engineer for the at least 25 years, and I work for a number of organizations, city, federal, large insurance companies, consultant, always in the area of fire safety, and with the goal of keeping the public safe and first responders safe. I became fascinated with the government's version of the events on 9/11. Because this is totally contrary to everything that I've ever experienced, either working in the field of fire safety or knowing what I know about mechanical engineering. It defies many fundamentals of mechanics and materials and physics and just many fundamental engineering concepts.
World Trade Center 7, NIST claims the fires were very large, very hot, and long-lasting, when in reality, observation, which has been researched by many people, shows these fires did not last very long. They were not in the locations where NIST claims they were at given times.
According to lead investigator Shyam Sunder of the National Institute for Standards and Technology, NIST, World Trade Center 7 collapsed at freefall acceleration for more than 100 feet of its fall. What does the speed of the collapse reveal to us?
Essentially, in less than 7 seconds, Tower 7 came down upon itself.
Building 7, NIST reports admits, fell at the rate of gravity for the first 100 feet. Well, that's impossible unless there's nothing resisting it.
It's just like taking your car keys out and just dropping them. That's how fast the building came down, for over 100 feet. And the only way you can get that is when there's zero resistance. And so what we're looking at is a building just coming straight down, falling right through itself with zero resistance. Buildings don't have zero resistance, which is why you feel comfortable walking into a building.
A building cannot do free fall with a huge steel structural system in place to support it without it being blown up. That's the only way it could come down at free fall.
The failure of all these connections as the primary means of structural failure is inconsistent with a natural gravitational collapse, and indicates the presence of other agents which would dismember these connections.
I'm David Chandler. I have a bachelor's degree in physics from Harvey Mudd College, and a master's in education from Claremont Graduate University, and another master's in mathematics from California Polytechnic University. I've been teaching for over 30 years. I'd heard people say, well, it came down at free fall or close to free fall and so forth, so I decided I'd measure it myself. I have a tool that I use in teaching, which allowed me to take a video and put a dot on each frame to follow the motion of things. And so you can measure speeds and accelerations, and it'll do the analysis. One of the fundamental laws of nature is the conservation of energy. In order for it to be falling down with zero resistance, it means that resistance had to have been removed by something else.
And NIST claims that the columns were buckling in the first several seconds before the free fall occurred. Now, I don't see how that's possible.
And in the final report, they modified it, they tried to doctor it up. They still tried to say that it was essentially correct, but then they modified it and they actually admitted there was a period of free fall involved. But they never changed their model. Like, how do you all of a sudden allow for free fall when they just got done explaining how it couldn't have been in free fall? If I were a scientist, I'd be embarrassed to try to put forward something like that. It was clearly a fraudulent argument.
In other words, NIST is telling us that the building below it ceased to exist for the first few seconds of the collapse of the building. Well, things in physics just don't cease to exist and cease to resist the forces that are on them.
Free falling for 8 stories. So, we know that happened. Okay, it's been measured and it's on videos. Everyone can see it. NIST has admitted it went into free fall for 8 stories. That's a bothersome part of the puzzle because NIST never explained it.
Absolutely no resistance to descent whatsoever.
The building didn't disappear so the building can fall for 100 feet at free fall speed. That's impossible. That's a violation of the fundamental law of physics that says that for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. So that evidence alone would indicate that the official story doesn't hold water.
There was no time for this elastic deformation and plastic deformation, which would have absorbed energy and decreased the descent to less than free fall speed. As energy is drained away from the system to deform those members, it would slow down the descending mass and cause a descent at less than free fall speed.
40,000 tons of structural steel in its structural system, and that is intended to keep it from going anywhere. A building cannot do free fall with a huge steel structural system in place to support it.
There's no resistance until the building gets down maybe halfway.
Buildings tend to be delayed as they collapse. They don't just pancake down like this in a very short period of time.
If the pancake theory works, it's going to hit hesitation, and there was no hesitation.
Going from motionless to free fall instantly.
One continuous motion. There couldn't have been any structural resistance.
Buildings just don't behave like that. If floors fall, they tend to fall and are braced by the floor directly beneath it. And there's some delay there.
This is inconsistent with the energy redistribution that would be required from the descending mass to the remaining structure.
Completely impossible. And NIST themselves have to recognize the implications of this. The fact that they haven't is fraudulent.
The connections are designed with a safety factor of 1.5 to 3 times the failure load for the member. So this assures that the member will always fail first in an elastic mode and then a plastic mode.
Ideally, the member would fail before the connection. You don't want the connections to fail first.
The connections failed first. Without any of the members exhibiting large deformations or deflections, over 400 connections per second had to fail in order for the members to be released and for the structure to descend at almost free fall rate.
To fail at the rate that they did progressively across the building, even if a floor were to collapse, it still wouldn't be able to collapse all of the connections simultaneously at the rate that it did without secondary explosion.
There's no hesitation. There was no hesitation when it was to hit story after story.
If you were to look at a standard moment frame steel connection, which is a welded connection between the beam and the column, it would take on the order of around 500,000 pounds to shear off one connection. And if you multiply that by 400, put maybe a safety factor of 4, you would require 50 million pounds of force per second in order to collapse the building the way it was shown based on the NIST report and what we saw on the video evidence of the video of the building that day. It's highly unlikely. Don't know how that could ever happen without secondary explosions. It's not logical or reasonable.
The fact that it's coming down at free fall says all of the energy is being used to just make it go straight down, which means it's coming down through itself and not breaking up the building as it goes. Something else has to be clearing the way. And that is smoking gun evidence to me. I think that's one of the primary pieces of evidence that these buildings really were demolished. They weren't just accidents that happened.
We might anticipate that an unevenly damaged building would fall over. Yet, videos of the collapse of Building 7 show a fairly symmetrical fall. How do we make sense of this?
The exterior of the building comes down fully, symmetrically, and at one time. Both sides of the building come down completely. This is fully indicative of full structural support being removed for at least six stories. That could not happen by fire.
If there was some fire in one corner, it would have collapsed maybe in that corner, but not the total building free falling.
Got that corner, it's going to want to topple over, but we didn't see that. We saw it come straight down.
If the buildings had come down by fire, we would have seen a more natural progression of collapse. We may have seen, you know, the buildings actually topple over to one side, certainly not coming down in its own footprint.
And clearly a more asymmetrical pattern should have been present.
I'm Kathy McGrade. I have a bachelor's in metallurgical engineering from New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology, which I got in 1979. I then spent the next 30 years with three startup companies. The symmetry is the smoking gun. It cannot happen that when you have asymmetric damage, you will get a perfectly symmetrical collapse.
It would not have been a uniform collapse. The building might have partially fallen over, but the building would not have collapsed as it did. This doesn't make any logical sense.
For it to come down straight down upon itself, you would need to basically take out the supports at the center, at the core.
The exterior columns on the outside as well as on the inside, at the bottom would have to be severed almost at the same time.
In my professional opinion, in my experience, for World Trade Center 7 to collapse straight down upon itself, as the video indicates, as everything that we've witnessed, the supports at the center essentially all had to be taken out at once.
Well, that's another indicator that this report is very suspect, because I would have expected in a classic implosion, as I've seen numerous times, is the core to fail. My name's Tom Sullivan. I worked for Controlled Demolition Incorporated, CDI, the top-rated explosive demolition firm in the world. As an explosives loader, my job was to place explosives in the buildings to prepare them for demolition. I was licensed while in New York by the New York Fire Department to handle explosives. And I worked on major projects such as Seattle Kingdom, the Three River Stadium, Philadelphia Naval Hospital, and Keyspan gas holders in New York. I would expect the center of the building to start moving first, and then as the implosion progresses, then the sides come in, then the rest of the building is involved. What I saw, it was a classic implosion. The center of the core, the penthouse area, starts to move first, and then the building follows along with it.
And there were so many columns in the building that were not affected by either the fires or the impact damage, and they all came down, just at once. So it's a little disheartening, and it's implausible.
When it's all finished, the outside walls from the lower floors are piled one on top of the other right in the middle of the building. Just like a house of cards if it were coming down.
Logic tells you that if you have a single failure at some random point in the building, that the entire building is not going to collapse. The collapse would have been a chaotic, random event. The building would have partially collapsed, possibly, but it didn't. There was a total collapse, and there's very few things that could explain that, none of which are addressed by the NIST report. According to NIST, the failure occurred at column 79 on level 12. This means basically, as they're talking about a single columnar collapse or failure that resulted in a total collapse of the building. That just does not make any sense.
As a structural engineer, I don't believe that the failure of one column would normally bring down an entire building in the way we saw World Trade Center 7 come down, because of redundancy, because of all the other columns in the building that were not affected.
NIST provided computer animations in support of their fire collapse theory. But what do independent engineers say about these animations?
When you observe the footage of how the building failed, and when you look at the animation of the failure, and compare that to what you actually observe in reality, I think they disprove their own theories. It is impossible for it to fail the way they said.
I've seen the animation sequence from the National Institute of Standards and Technology for their model, their mathematical model of the collapse of building number 7. And they have the inside members, their one column gave way, which they claim resulted in the collapse of all the surrounding members, and then this precipitated a global collapse.
The NIST computer model, actually, they had done a bunch of finite element models of the connections, individual connections, so they had connections failing before the members failed. Four-part connections, when three of the four parts failed, they considered it to be all failed.
The exterior of the NIST World Trade Center 7 computer simulation model, which they put together to try to explain their theory, shows large, very large deformations which are not observed in the video of the actual event. Yet they don't attempt to explain this in the report on why their model doesn't represent or replicate reality. What's actually happening within this computer model, it's behaving like a natural collapse would. It would be deforming the exterior of the building if the whole interior was collapsing prior to the exterior. What we're seeing is what would happen in a natural collapse, and what we see on the real video is not a natural collapse.
So I think that the NIST model is flawed. Of course, they won't release all of their parameters that they use to model the collapse, and that is a primary problem for them.
NIST has also repeatedly refused to release computer input data that was requested through the Freedom of Information Act from them in the past concerning World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7.
What do these professionals conclude about the destruction of World Trade Center Building 7?
There had to be some agent that was destroying the connections in Building Number 7 at 400 connections per second, and the only thing that I can see that would be capable of doing this would be explosive devices at the connections. And this is why I think that there has to be a new investigation to find out the real physical causes for all these members to act in an atypical fashion.
And I certainly believe that it had to have been controlled demolition, controlled charges, explosives, something of that type, because it was a sudden failure.
Controlled demolition. There's no way that fire did what they said it did to that building. Impossible. Couldn't happen. It just did not make sense that a building that had a few minor fires in it could possibly succumb the way it did. If there was damage, it would have been minor. There might have been some deflection of a beam or two here or there, but not a total and unequivocal complete collapse. It just doesn't ring true.
A few fires in that building, and I mean, they weren't even raging. And how could that cause a building to collapse as if it were imploded? Couldn't happen.
To me, it was obvious that there was some controlled demolition and some explosions involved.
When I saw Building 7 fall, it, to me, appeared to be controlled demolition because it fell in free fall manner into itself. It is my opinion, as a former 12 Bravo combat engineer, well trained in the use of explosives, that this building, all three buildings, were brought down as a result of controlled demolitions.
This is the original site of the World Trade Center Twin Towers. Construction is now underway where dramatic new facilities are being erected. Just 10 years ago, the planes hit the towers, cutting through some exterior and interior supporting structural steel columns. The fuel from the planes ignited office fires across several floors. According to the official reports, the structural steel frame was weakened and failed, causing a total progressive collapse of each tower. Does the official explanation make sense? Was there a comprehensive investigation that examined all of the evidence? Let's look at the details.
These buildings were designed to take multiple impacts from airliners.
I walked into the office, and the first words that I heard was, a plane's just run into the World Trade Center. And my initial thought was, well, that's okay. It's built to withstand a 707.
He stated that the fuel would be dumped into the building, but the building would still be there, although most of the fuel blew out the opposite side of the building.
These buildings are built to handle several times the load above them. Those perimeter columns could handle five times the load above them, and the core columns could handle three times the load above them.
The majority of the jet fuel was burnt up instantly in the big fireball, and it was gone. The fires that were left were office furnishings and carpet and things like that. A lot of things in these kind of buildings have to be fire resistant by nature. It's required by code. So there really isn't a whole lot of fuel in there to begin with.
The media portrayed these fires as being extremely hot, but the fires were not that hot in World Trade Center 1 and 2. If you look at the NIST zone data, you could see this. And to use our own powers of observation, you could tell by seeing these fires and seeing black smoke come out the windows, that means that the fires were oxygen starved and it was incomplete combustion, and so it was a low temperature fire.
I am Robert Podolsky. I have a master's degree in theoretical physics from Xavier University in Cincinnati. I worked for 10 years as a professional physicist, engineer, systems analyst for government and for industry, companies like Avco, GE, Bendix, and also Air Force Avionics Lab and the Coast Guard Electronics Division. I looked up in a manual the burning temperature of jet fuel and found that under the conditions that existed at the World Trade Center on 9/11, that jet fuel had to have been burning at about 750 degrees Fahrenheit. I also noticed that the official explanation of what happened there was that the heat from the fire supposedly softened the steel and thereby brought the buildings down. If you have a flame at 750 degrees, you can hold that flame under a steel beam forever and you'll never reach a high enough temperature to bend steel, let alone melt it. So immediately I knew at that point that the official explanation was dead wrong. There was no way those flames could have possibly brought about the collapse of the building.
It did not seem possible that these towers that were designed to withstand the impact of a 707 could possibly collapse in such a short order of time from the time that they were hit. There's no way the building was designed to take the impact of one, if not more, multiple airplanes. They were designed to withstand hurricane force winds of up to 140 miles an hour.
My first reaction was, that looks like controlled demolitions. However, I believed the official story because it was played to me over and over again. I heard repeated experts telling me that this was terrorists that did this and that it was planes that brought those buildings down. So I accepted the official story.
The NIST testing of the Twin Tower floor assemblies done at Underwriters Laboratories. This was done per ASTM E-119 in a 2-hour, 2,000-degree fire test. During the test, the main trusses sagged approximately 4 inches after 60 minutes and 6 inches after 100 minutes. Yet NIST had the main trusses sagging well over 40 inches in their models.
Than a slow, groaning collapse that we might anticipate. The Twin Towers show, in the videos, a very rapid, sudden onset of destruction. What does this imply?
I'm Frank Conan, a practicing civil engineer in the state of California. I have a Bachelor of Science from Chico State, which I received in 1988. I've been a licensed civil engineer since 1993. I specialize in bridge construction, retaining wall construction, small building construction, bridge demolition, and I have experience in bridge design and building design. Structural steel is required by building and design codes to prevent catastrophic failure and loss of public life. Everybody's seen the building collapses on 9/11, and it was shocking how fast the buildings collapsed.
The way the buildings fell was not indicative of the way a building that's in distress collapses.
This doesn't happen with structural steel buildings and never has and never will again. We assume that fires could destroy a building. Why people select steel buildings is because they would destroy slowly. It would gradually twist and bend and give people plenty of time and safety in getting out of the building.
The basic philosophy of the building codes in the last 75 to 80 years has been to ensure ductile failure of the members to provide for the public safety. Under this philosophy, members that are overloaded will deform elastically within the elastic range of the material, with increasingly large deformations and deflections. This gives rise to large deformations that are visible and apparent to the occupants of the structure, and this gives them time to evacuate the structure.
I would not have expected the whole building to just give in at once, and I thought it rather odd that they fell almost perfectly in very similar ways. It seemed odd that lightning would strike twice.
Upon further review of the videos of the tower's destruction in the 9/11 Blueprint for Truth DVD, I was surprised to see the upper floors of the North Tower, the upper 15 floors of the North Tower, implode prior to any destruction of the tower below, because it would be logical that as a result of the plane crash that the upper 15 floors would start to damage the floors below, not the floors above.
And it certainly would stay in the damage zone. It would not drop down through 80,000 ton of insulated, undamaged structural steel and do it in 12 seconds.
I discuss the NIST claim that the upper section of each of the towers crushed the lower section. However, when you watch video closely, in the case of World Trade Center 1, you'll see that the upper section disintegrates itself. Its lower stories are breaking up before it even impacts the lower section. It appears to be a controlled demolition of its own, of the upper section.
The tops of the buildings were basically disintegrated.
The top section, pushing on the bottom section, it's going to meet equal forces as it goes. Both sections are going to be demolished at the same rate. So by the time you've crushed up 15 stories below it, the top 15 stories are also going to be crushed. And so there's nothing left now to crush the rest of the building. So there's so many paradoxes here. A little tiny chunk of the building can't possibly fall and crush the entire structure below it.
Well, there's demolitions done in France, which use what we call the Vernage technique, where they take out a couple floors worth of columns with hydraulics. They take the columns out and they let the building, the upper section of the building, drop two full floors. And when it impacts the lower section, there's a very definitive, observable jolt, deceleration, and velocity loss.
You're looking for a jolt. That this thing, if it actually comes down and hits, you should be able to see the point at which they actually impact, because it would actually slow down the motion of the falling block.
And you can see it in the graph. It is not there in the case of the North Tower.
It never slows down. It accelerates the entire time. And that was what was extremely significant. So I published a paper about that. It's in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. And so if you had the top section acting like a pile driver, if in fact it actually hit and made an impact, it was effectively crushing anything, pushing hard on this core structure below it, the core structure is going to push back equally hard. And that's what's going to cause the top section of the building to slow down. But the fact that it's constantly accelerating downward is evidence that it didn't slow down. It's not actually hitting and engaging with the structure below it in any way that could demolish it. The top section is not crushing the bottom section of the building, or it would meet resistance.
I am Richard Heumann. I am a retired professional electrical engineer. I went to Brooklyn Polytechnic Institute and received the Bachelor of Electrical Engineering degree in 1954. I worked for Joseph Flooring for 41 years and was principal chief electrical engineer for the World Trade Center complex. I was very familiar with the Twin Towers elevator systems because we took over conceptual maintenance and improvements of the elevator systems after the project was completed. I actually ran and rode up and down elevator shafts on the top of a car going 1,200 feet a minute. You could imagine the experience. I'm very familiar with the interior structure that surrounded the elevator shafts and the accessibility which the elevator companies had 24/7. The only way that I can see that the towers could have collapsed is that the interior columns were compromised. In Tower 1, unless my eyes were deceiving me, before the tower started collapsing from the top, the antenna started to fall. And the antenna, of course, was over the middle of the elevator shafts. And, of course, their access to the elevator shafts gave them total access to the surrounding core columns, the interior of the core columns.
NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, acknowledges that the towers came down at essentially free-fall acceleration. What are the implications of that admission?
The measurements have indicated that Tower 1 collapsed in about 11 seconds and Tower 2 collapsed in about 9 seconds. And the argument goes that this is essentially the rate at which free-fall would happen.
I had a friend that asked me if it was possible for the Twin Towers to achieve near free fall speed when they collapsed.
The Twin Towers could not have come straight down through the thousands of tons of structural steel through the greatest resistance, the resistance of 80,000 tons of structural steel at the speed of practically free fall. That just would not happen.
There are columns of steel around the exterior of the building and within the core, all of which are there to prevent the thing from falling down. And so even if something falls on it, it's not going to immediately just go pop, 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 pop like that floor by floor. If it's going to collapse, it's going to have to take some time to weaken the structure below it.
This structure was capable of holding 3 to 5 times the weight. And here it is falling through it with the resistance of only 1/3 of its weight. Roughly 90% of the resistance has been removed. And what's happening is the top section is not crushing down the lower section like a pile driver, which is the picture that NIST basically is painting. It's actually falling into material that's already been pulverized, that's offering very little resistance. It's just coming down through pre-pulverized material. One of the fundamental laws of nature is the conservation of energy.
There was no time for this elastic deformation and plastic deformation, which would have absorbed energy and decreased the descent to less than free fall speed. As energy is drained away from the system to deform those members, it would slow down the descending mass and cause a descent at less than free fall speed.
This is high school physics, and our whole society is being led to believe that these fundamental laws of physics, hard science, don't apply anymore. I think that should really frighten all of us.
Over 400 connections per second had to fail in order for the members to be released and for the structure to descend at almost free fall rate.
Structural connections not only had to fail nearly simultaneously, but in sequential order.
The buildings fall at a speed which can only occur if the structure has been removed, the vertical structure.
This block accelerates straight down, or it's picking up speed downward continually. It doesn't slow down, it just continues to gain speed.
From what I understand, the buildings actually accelerated as they came down, meaning they were not getting resistance from these massive columns in the center of the core of this building. The core of this building was very heavy. They're huge columns, huge.
I could not see how those massive, very thick columns could just snap like that. I would have expected most of them to stay intact with the floors collapsing around them.
I'm Alfred Lopez. I'm a registered professional structural engineer in the state of Michigan and have been in private practice for 40 years with Lopez Engineering. I've worked on several high-rise projects with office buildings above parking decks and high-rise apartment buildings here in the Detroit area. I've done numerous investigations of failures of buildings because of fire and wind damage. I was shocked at how the buildings collapsed, but expected that they would have come down much slower, that they would have tipped over, that the whole thing did not make sense. And ever since then, I had a hard time believing that the fires did drop those buildings.
I thought that given the way the planes hit the building, one side would have given away first and it just would have fallen off or fallen over at a steep angle, but the way the whole thing just gave way at once and started to plummet down without slowing down as it went down, again, just like the controlled demolition I witnessed personally.
The area below the damage zone where the planes flew in and where the fire was, that area below that, those 80 or 90 stories, 80,000 tons of structural steel was not damaged in any way. Yet you stood there and watched it destroy itself, wiping out floor by floor all 287 structural columns as if they didn't exist underneath the damage zone.
According to the first responders' oral histories, which were reported in the New York Times, over 100 first responders reported sounds of explosions and flashes of light at the onset of destruction of both towers. These were not discussed in the NIST report. What did these eyewitnesses actually see and hear?
All the other evidence of seeing flashes and explosions and the melted metal and the dust particles and with the explosive chemicals found in the debris, there's just a lot of questions about what's been going on, and that these questions have not been answered or even addressed in any sort of full way.
We have eyewitness testimony of firemen, policemen, news reporters, and occupants of the building to explosions. an enormous number of eyewitness testimonies.
There was an heavy-duty explosion
inside the lobby.
Was that a secondary explosion?
Yes, it was.
There were numerous secondary explosions taking place in that building. There were continuous explosions.
There was a secondary explosion, probably a device either planted before or on the aircraft that did not explode until an hour later.
Then there was those secondary explosions and then the subsequent collapses.
It sounded like gunfire, you know, bang, 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 and then all of a sudden, three big explosions.
About 50 consecutive bangs, and it went, fell down like a waterfall.
And we heard the noise associated with an implosion.
We heard a very loud blast, an explosion.
We heard a loud explosion.
At that point, we heard a large boom.
Do you know if it was an explosion or if it was a building collapse?
To me, it sounded like an explosion.
There was another major explosion.
All of a sudden, you hear explosion, and you could see the building starting to collapse.
Huge explosion that we all heard and felt.
We could hear a rumble, which was about 5 seconds long, preceding the actual collapse, and then a boom when each of those towers collapsed.
Just seconds ago, there was a huge explosion, and it appears right now the second World Trade Tower has just collapsed.
I was about five blocks away when I heard explosions.
Then you heard from far away, boom, boom.
And you heard the boom, 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 boom.
It was like as if they had detonated.
Yeah,
as if they were planned to take down a building. Boom, 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 boom.
And it just started going pop. It just started going boom, 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 boom. And he goes, how fast? I go like firecrackers.
One of Ms. Ether's excuses was that there were no blast sounds heard by witnesses or recorded. There's so many videos of witnesses from that day that report explosions. There's radio transmissions from the FDNY. We have the transcripts that were recorded, you know, back in 2001 of all these firefighters and first responders reporting explosions. There's no doubt they were heard.
In the oral histories of the emergency personnel taken down late 2001 and early 2002, there are over 100 individuals who make comments about seeing, hearing, and feeling explosions in those buildings. These oral histories were documented well before NIST started their World Trade Center investigation in September 2002. This testimony should have caused the presumption that there was a good chance explosive residue would be found and justified testing for it, rather than the opposite.
Reviewing the some of the eyewitness accounts and people hearing what sound like explosions and things like that. Again, it didn't seem very plausible for any other type of cause for such an event.
It doesn't look like a collapse. It's like a huge mushrooming, billowing kind of an event. That whole thing looks nothing like a building falling down. It's a building being blown up, and it's being blown up progressively from the top down. That's what the physics shows.
And NIST acknowledges in their response to a request for correction that they are unable to provide a full explanation of the total collapse. Yet they refuse to consider the possibility that explosives or some other form of demolition device could have been used to cause the collapses of the towers. And the fact that controlled demolition is consistent with all the available technical evidence. And the response to that request for correction is NIST simply saying they're unable to provide a full explanation for the total collapse, even though that was their task given to them by Congress.
The core structure of the building had to have been destroyed by other means.
FEMA documents a 1,200-foot diameter debris field around each tower. Videos show multi-ton steel sections of hundreds of individual steel pieces ejecting out of the towers at 60 miles an hour for a distance of 600 feet. They also show clouds of debris pulverized in mid-air and isolated explosive ejections as many as 60 stories below the so-called crush zone. Videos also show the near total destruction of both towers. What does all this tell us about the forces and energies involved in the destruction?
The spread of debris in a large radius around each tower, what we see is an outward explosion of material beyond the perimeters of each footprint. And this is not expected, and it's not congruent with the reports of our government.
Debris that was shooting out for hundreds of feet in all directions at 70 miles an hour, leaving the 80th floor of the North Tower and making a fairly level trajectory, that to me is fairly alarming.
Large multi-ton beams were hurled hundreds of yards laterally. Gravity works vertically, not laterally.
The number I got was 78 miles an hour. So something's happening to throw these things horizontally at those kinds of speeds. And here it is trailing white smoke the whole time. It really is indicative of some kind of explosion.
The individual explosions that I noticed 20 and 30 and 40 stories below the collapsing structure, those are what we demolitions guys call squibs. And that's another characteristic that seems to be evident.
Well, in the case of the South Tower, you can see these jets of black smoke being ejected from many locations on many different floors above the level of the impact. There's a whole bunch of these squibs or puffs that are coming out the side of the building. And naysayers tend to say, well, that's just air being blown out the windows because you have like an accordion effect. It's being compressed. Well, it's going on at a lot of different levels at the same time is one thing. And if you're compressing it out here, if you're blowing out the windows down here, how are you getting the air pressure? I mean, it doesn't really work to say it's just air pressure. I estimated these are coming out faster than 100 miles an hour.
The impact of the floors pancaking upon themselves would create gushes of air out the side, but not the kind of explosive force that we saw that would throw I-beams across the street into the windows of other buildings.
The ejection of the materials out of the building, the manner in which it fell, the speed at which it fell, it exhibited all the signs of demolitions and the completeness of the destruction down to their individual elements.
When the South Tower was destroyed, at first it looked like it was going to land in the street or take a building out next to it, and then all of a sudden it disappears in this huge cloud of smoke, which didn't seem to make sense at the time.
How can those steel columns, the massive steel columns that they are, supporting that weight of that building, virtually disappear? Why aren't they poking up straight out of that rubble at the bottom of the building?
As an architect, I would expect to see larger portions of the building floors, the decking, the steel decking, the concrete topping, much larger remnants of what the structural components of this building was. There were just small fragments of strewn steel components. There should have been much larger pieces for examination on the ground. After all, there was 110 floors in each building, and each floor plate was over an acre in size.
The fact that it was all reduced to rubble and powder just did not make sense at all.
We have no explanation of how the concrete was pulverized. It takes an enormous amount of energy, way beyond what we have in aviation fuel.
There were two substations on the 108th floor, the 75th floor, and the 41st floor, and the 7th floor. At those eight locations, there were four transformers in each substation that weighed over 30,000 pounds. In the substations on the mechanical floors in each tower, the transformers would not explode on their own. They were air-cooled, dry-type transformers. And yet, after the collapse, there was, as from what was reported, there was no evidence of them being found at the bottom of the towers. I wonder why. It was a shame that after the collapse that a forensic engineering unit didn't go into the debris and try to find at that time why the towers had collapsed. I'm sure there was other evidence that could have given a better indication at the time that there was something else wrong.
In In its report on World Trade Center 7, which came out in May of 2002, FEMA documents in Appendix C steel that has been melted and even partially evaporated, resembling Swiss cheese. What are we to make of this?
My name is Jeff Fair. I have a PhD in material science and engineering from the University of Minnesota. I have a BA in physics from Brigham Young University. I've worked with solid-state reactions. I've worked characterizing materials, semiconductor materials, thin films. I currently do a lot of work with nanoparticles as well as solid-state reactions. So Jonathan Barnett's study, which I thought was very well done and quite extensive, is all documented by FEMA in Appendix C in their BPAT report that was May of 2002. Unfortunately, it was never used in the NIST report.
My name is Jason Cheshire, and I'm a licensed professional engineer in the province of Ontario in Canada. And I have been working in the field of hydrometallurgy for the past 10 years for a major company here in Canada. And I'd like to know why NIST excluded the document from FEMA in Appendix C that documented the evidence of melting steel. Why is this not included? Why is this forensic evidence not being included in the report?
First of all, let's go back to your basic premise that there was a pool of molten steel. I know of absolutely nobody, and no eyewitness who said so, nobody who's produced it.
You'd get down below and you'd see molten steel.
Like a little
molten rim. Steel running down the channel rails. Like you're in a foundry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
like lava.
From a volcano.
Actually melted beams where it was molten steel that was being dug out.
Underground, it was still so hot that molten metal dripped down the sides of a wall.
And the cleanup was very difficult in the beginning. Steel was coming out red in certain areas from the first couple of weeks.
This fused element of steel, molten steel.
And they pulled off a big block of concrete, and there was a little river of steel flowing.
My name is Mark Basile. I'm a chemical engineer. I have a Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering from Worcester Polytechnic Institute. I've worked for about 25 years in industry, and the majority of what I do is analytical work and figuring out what materials are composed of, why they are what they are, why they do what they do. There were sections of them that clearly showed melting. They had sections that were thinned away, and there were actually holes through them, and some of the ends were just melted away or even possibly evaporated away.
I'm Kathy McGrade. I have a bachelor's in metallurgical engineering from New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology, which I got in 1979. I then spent the next 30 years with three startup companies. In an office fire, you cannot generate enough heat to melt steel. And yet we have evidence of molten iron in the microspheres, in the rubble pile, and the metal pouring out of the side of the tower.
We could have filled up the Twin Towers with jet fuel and burned it all up, and that does not cause a fire hot enough to melt structural steel.
My name is Gary Warner. I'm a mechanical engineer. I hold a professional certification from the Association of British Columbia. I worked as in the project engineering department of the casting plant of Elcan, the aluminum company of Canada, one of the largest aluminum smelters on the planet at the time. And in that smelter, we turned aluminum oxide into aluminum, molten aluminum. Molten aluminum is silver. It's not yellow, it's silver. It looks like mercury. The yellow molten metal that I saw pouring out of the South Tower is indicative of molten iron. I was a bit incredulous when I learned that NIST claimed that the molten metal was aluminum. I mean, it doesn't look at all like molten aluminum. Looks like iron, molten iron. That's what it looks like. And I've seen tons of it. We used to cast this in Elcan. They still cast it. I spent 2 years casting that.
I'm David Gregg.
have a master's and PhD in chemical engineering from the University of Illinois. Afterwards, I went to work for Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, where I worked there for more than 30 years. You cannot get a flame hot enough to start the metal, to molten, make it molten in the first place so that this other process takes off. I don't know of any mechanism for that. The only way that's known that a carbonaceous material can cause steel or iron oxide to turn into a molten metal is in a blast furnace. Yeah, and that's very different than what we had.
An incendiary used by the military, thermite is a compound of iron oxide and aluminum, which when ignited sustains an extreme heat reaction, creating molten iron. In just 2 seconds, thermite can reach temperatures over 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit, quite enough to liquefy steel. We know that open-air fires cannot burn hot enough to melt steel, but metal had melted at the base of the towers.
The next question is, how do you get the sulfur in these pieces of steel or in the debris? And that question is unanswered. There's a version of thermite called thermate, which has sulfur in the thermate to, and what the sulfur does is it's sort of like salt on ice.
Appendix C of the FEMA report describes sulfur residues on the World Trade Center steel. The New York Times called this the deepest mystery of all. Sulfur slightly lowers the melting point of iron, and iron oxide and iron sulfide.
And it just basically makes the steel melt at a lower temperature. So instead of having to bring the steel up to 1500 centigrade, you can slice through it with material that's at 900 or 1000 degrees centigrade. And if you do a search on Google for thermite and building demolition, you can find all sorts of wonderful devices that have been fabricated and invented that use thermite for building demolitions.
Thermite is, in the old-fashioned thermite, is a mixture of pulverized aluminum and pulverized rust. And if you can get this mixture to react, which is not so easy, it produces tremendous heat, and this is what you call an incendiary. An incendiary is something which can be used to destroy something by the means of heat, while an explosive is something which acts with pressure. It knocks things apart. Now, the old-fashioned incendiary is not an explosive. It is still used for military purposes for melting iron structures.
Practical applications of thermite involve things such as equipment decommissioning in the military. When they have a piece of artillery or a tank or something like that that they don't want to leave behind to the enemy, they throw what are called grenades, thermite grenades, down the barrel, let's say. But thermite does not explode. It simply reacts, produces large amounts of heat, and molten material.
In the case of thermite cutting charges, you would have heard far less noise, since they are worked by thermal heating, melting of the steel, rather than an explosive cutting, as in RDX charges.
I'm Kim Ireland. I have a degree in chemical engineering from Clarkson University in 1963. After graduating, I served 2 years as a reserve officer in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, where, among other things, I had training in explosives such as C4. I was involved in the industrial chemical industry for 20 years with major companies. There were reports of molten steel having been seen in the rubble pile of all three buildings, and I knew that jet fuel, which is essentially kerosene, is not capable of melting steel nor iron. Kerosene or jet fuel burns at less than 1600 degrees Fahrenheit, and molten steel needs at least 2700 degrees Fahrenheit in order to melt.
The thing that most struck me about the 9/11 incident was, following the incident, how overflights had detected with infrared camera 1400 degree Fahrenheit hotspots on the surface of Ground Zero. And that being there for a week, you know, indicates that there was something very hot going on below the surface.
Another question that may haunt the new Freedom Tower. According to USGS, they found as much as 6% of the World Trade Center dust consisted of tiny, previously molten iron spheres. What does this tell us about the temperatures generated in the tower's destruction?
My name is Adam Parrott, and I have a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from Queen's University. I've been working for an environmental consulting firm for a number of years. When the USGS collected samples of the World Trade Center dust, they found the iron microspheres. Insofar, the USGS does not have a valid explanation for the presence of these iron microspheres.
But I've independently seen thermitic activity within two separate independent samples of World Trade Center dust.
I'm Jerry Lobdell. I'm a retired physicist and chemical engineer. I have a BS in chemical engineering from Texas Tech, and I have extensive coursework in mathematics and physics from the University of Texas at Austin. I've had broad experience in analysis and applied research, 30-year professional history spanning physics, chemical engineering, statistical analysis and modeling, and operations research. So what do the microspheres contain? Iron is the main element, and then it has smaller portions of aluminum, sulfur, a trace of manganese, a trace of potassium. Most of them are less than about a tenth of an inch in diameter, and they're spherical, and they're found in all of the dust blown out of the buildings during collapse, no matter where in Manhattan that dust is picked up.
You must have had a much hotter heat source for you to get 2,700 degrees Fahrenheit in order to melt the steel, melt the iron, to get these spheres, these molten spheres. Your heat source must be something like a chemical reaction, an exothermic chemical reaction that reacts, in the case of thermite, reacts at 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit.
My contention, based on finding thermite residue in the dust, is that it happened before. It didn't happen after in the fires that ensued in the rubble pile afterwards. It's all the characteristics of the microspheres, along with what I see in the attack of the beams that were actually found, tell me that thermite was involved in melting those steel beams.
Out of the ashes of the World Trade Center devastation rises the Freedom Tower, whose foundation, however, is shrouded in question. For example, in the World Trade Center dust, an international team of scientists find an advanced form of highly energetic nanothermite composites. What is it, and where does it come from?
My name is Nils Harriet. I have a master and a PhD in chemistry, and I'm associate professor at the University of Copenhagen, and I have been so for almost 40 years. I have published close to 60 peer-reviewed papers in the best journals, and currently I'm involved with research X-ray time-resolved spectroscopy on time scales of 1 millionth of 1 millionth of a second. In the dust, we found what we characterize as unreacted thermitic material in the shape of some very tiny red gray chips, which have different properties. Most importantly is they're still reacting, some of them, and in the reaction they produce molten iron, which is the prime indication of a thermitic reaction, and such a reaction can be used to destroy steel structures. What we have found is a modern version of thermite, which we call nanothermite, which is produced in a different way. It is not just two powder is being mixed, the material is actually built from the atom scale up. We call it the bottom-up procedure, which is what you do in nanotechnology. This has two consequences for the nanothermite, which separates, distinguishes it from the classical thermite. First, the ingredients are much smaller, which means they're reacting faster and they're more easily ignited.
The primary elements in the red material are aluminum, iron oxide, as well as silicon and carbon. The iron oxide appears in faceted grains, approximately 100 nanometers across. The aluminum appears in thin platelets, about 40 nanometers thick. It is the small size of the particles involved in this material that allow us to characterize it as nanothermite. In ordinary thermite, the particle size is much larger, and hence ordinary thermite is an incendiary. Whereas as the particle size becomes smaller and smaller, it can become explosive. Superthermite is sometimes called. This red material contains also a significant amount of carbon, and the formulation of nanothermite as described by National Laboratory publications also implies the presence of carbon. Very typically, the organic is used with nanothermite in order to produce gas, that is a very high pressure gas that makes the nanothermite an explosive. We do have descriptions from the Livermore National Laboratory in particular of how they fabricated this material, but to fabricate it is not so easy. This is discussed in our paper in the Open Chemical Physics Journal published in April of 2009. So far, none of these papers have been refuted in the literature, the scientific literature. So that means they are unchallenged in the scientific sense. They stand as an indictment, really, of the official story of 9/11.
One of the things I'd like to stress about these chips is that they really shouldn't be there. They're not a natural formed agglomeration of aluminum from the aircraft or materials that were in the building and iron oxide that got knocked off. It isn't just a haphazard bringing together of iron oxide and aluminum, which is the basic components of thermite. This is a material that is made up of nano-sized particles that are all very uniform, very symmetrical.
The formulation of the gray chips is nano-sized. This cannot be paint. Paint does not have these exotic properties. It's impossible.
We do not know which role is played by the red gray chips that we found in the dust. But we know, and this was already totally clear before we started investigating the dust, that both explosives and incendiaries were used in the controlled demolition of World Trade Center. This is quite obvious because of other observations, the molten iron and other findings in the dust.
This is material that is of military use that really shouldn't be there.
And our whole society is being led to believe that these fundamental laws of physics, hard science, don't apply anymore. I think that should really frighten all of us.
Just all the other evidence of seeing flashes and explosions and the melted metal and the dust particles and with the chemical, the explosive chemicals found in the debris. There's just a lot of questions about what's been going on, and that these questions have not been answered or even addressed in any sort of full way.
My name is Rick Folks. I'm a structural engineer with over 40 years' experience in engineering. I'm a president of my own engineering business here in Arizona since 1983. Prior to that, I was a vice president with prominent engineering firms in the Phoenix area. I have experience designing large structures, including power plant structures, shopping center structures, schools, commercial buildings, you name it. I know structural design, and I know that on September 11th, when I saw those twin towers coming down, I knew there had to be more to the story than just a fire causing those failures. That had to be a controlled demolition that we were witnessing. The government has lied to us, and we need to get to the truth. Those victims deserve the truth. They deserve justice. What we have right now is a travesty of justice.
A Freedom of Information Act request to NIST by a registered structural engineer for calculations and analysis substantiating the walk-off failures of the horizontal girders from their seats at columns 79 and 81 was denied by NIST, with the claim that releasing this data might jeopardize public safety. How could it possibly jeopardize public safety to tell people in the industry, engineers who were responsible for designing these buildings, how this failure could occur?
That implies that anybody who requests or demands these calculations is a threat to public safety.
Science is never secret when it's done right. Science is a way of finding out that is self-correcting and involves many people. Science isn't science unless it's published, unless it's openly published and made available for criticism. The thing that's most important about science is that it's a way of knowing, and it's a way of knowing that anyone can participate in. At the end of any kind of science activity, people will agree that they have collected evidence that illustrates a hypothesis, and if the evidence is contradictory to the hypothesis, one has to abandon that hypothesis and look for another one.
The explanations from FEMA and from NIST don't add up, but there is enormous circumstantial evidence, circumstantial and actually physical evidence as well, that would lead us to a different conclusion. And the conclusion is controlled demolition.
It was a shame that after the collapse that a forensic unit, a forensic engineering unit, didn't go into the debris and try to find at that time why the towers had collapsed. I'm sure there was other evidence that could have given a better indication at the time that there was something else wrong.
Any honest investigator would be looking at this and looking for explosives and so forth. The NIST investigation didn't go there. They just would not look for explosives. There have been explosives found in the dust and the debris, but this has been the work of independent researchers, not NIST.
And the physical chemistry of everything that I wrote about is consistent with no other hypothesis. And all of the testimony of eyewitnesses, all of the video evidence, supports only controlled demolition as the cause of all three World Trade Center buildings' destruction.
You don't have to be a chemical engineer to question that official story. It's very, very obvious. Both Building 7 and the towers were brought down by demolition. It couldn't have been any other possible way.
That conclusion I come to based upon, first of all, my training and my education, particularly my experience in blowing up major structures that had been designed to withstand blasts. The experience that I had gained in the military and as an engineer was irrefutable. Those buildings were brought down by explosives. Well, the American Society of Civil Engineers was brought into this investigation early on, issued a report without any significant forensic examination. For the American Society of Civil Engineers to ignore those events is extremely disturbing and is a violation, in my opinion, of their professional code of ethics. The only thing that you can say about their participation in this is that it must have been an orchestrated cover-up.
So the preconceived notion of NIST is that there's no evidence for explosives, and so there's no point in looking. That is the most unscientific thing that you can possibly think of, not to look because you don't expect to find evidence, and in fact the evidence is overwhelming. They state these conclusions for which there's virtually no evidence, and then they ignore conclusions that can be drawn from the evidence.
It is my opinion, as a former 12 Bravo combat engineer, well trained in the use of explosives, that this building, all three buildings, were brought down as a result of controlled demolitions.
Elevator company personnel had 24/7 access to the shafts, which is the normal time in the evening and early morning hours when they perform their maintenance. And, of course, their access to the elevator shafts gave them total access to the surrounding core columns, the interior of the core columns.
It took some kind of consciousness raising on my part before I was willing to look at the possibilities. And really, you need to go where the evidence leads.
We know we've been lied to about 9/11. We don't know for sure who did it. We don't know exactly how they did everything. And that's why we need a new investigation to find out. But in the meantime, there are things we do know. We do know that there was a massive cover-up, that there was evidence hidden and destroyed.
And given these conclusions, what remedy do these professionals recommend?
The three skyscrapers were taken down in a controlled demolition. And all we're asking for is a new investigation. And the NIST also will investigate the dust for remaining explosives.
At Firefighters for 9/11 Truth, that's what we're asking for, is we're asking for an investigation that follows national standards.
I'm Jody Gibbs. I was licensed for general building and heavy construction as well as architecture over 35 years ago. I was educated at Yale University, the Harvard Graduate School of Design, the Yale Graduate School of Art and Architecture, and I taught at MIT as an adjunct faculty for a number of years in the Graduate School of Architecture. My reasons for looking and demanding and urging people to see that we get a judicial investigation are really very simple. No high-rise steel structure has ever been destroyed by a fire in the history of construction. We have eyewitness testimony of firemen, policemen, news reporters, and occupants of the building to explosions, an enormous number of eyewitness testimonies. Fourth, the buildings fall at a speed which can only occur if the structure has been removed, the vertical structure. Large multi-ton beams were hurled hundreds of yards laterally. Gravity works vertically, not laterally. We also now have the evidence of thermite and thermate explosives. Most of these things were not even mentioned in the 9/11 Commission report. It's for this reason I urge all architects and engineers to look into the matter, look at the evidence that is available, and sign on to the demands of architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth in demanding that we get a judicial investigation.
I signed the petition for Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth because I felt it was an organization trying to get at the truth of what in fact actually happened, what brought those buildings down. So what I'm looking for is a new investigation where all of the original information and tests and hypotheses are re-examined, as well as the ones that have surfaced since, the new ones, including the allegations of controlled demolition.
I don't think any of us are pointing fingers at this time. We're just saying, let's reopen it. Let's look at it objectively. Let's look at the evidence, not these fabricated computer models and hearsay and all these predetermined conclusions. Let's really open it up again and investigate this thing properly and then come to conclusions.
In my 37 years of experience as a structural engineer, I've never seen modes of failure such as have been exhibited in the case of these buildings, and that's why I feel that we need a new independent investigation to explain the destruction of these three buildings.
I strongly support an independent investigation into what actually occurred. There are many problems, and in fact, as a forensic engineer, I can tell you that unfortunately, the government has destroyed much of the evidence, though we could do an appropriate investigation, and an investigation could be done that would be independent of the government, independent of all of the influences that obviously were in effect during the NIST investigation.
Based on the evidence available, I feel that we must demand a new investigation into the destruction of the World Trade Center towers and NIST itself.
We need to have an investigation of NIST themselves. I believe that the reports that came out are not true. I believe there's a lot of information that was omitted, blatantly or otherwise.
I strongly feel that an international commission should be formed to look at this matter in an unbiased manner and come to a conclusion that could be presented to the entire engineering community.
We have a professional responsibility, and I urge every engineer and architect and demolitions expert and anybody that has any knowledge in this field to examine the evidence and stand up and be counted, because the rest of the world is depending upon us.
I would like to see a real investigation. I'd like to see people on the inside who really know what happened. I'd like to see some of those come out. There's some very good scientists, I'm sure, at NIST, and their life's work is getting distorted and used for political purposes.
What happened on 9/11 is not something that is just going to go away. This is very pertinent to us today. I wish to further the investigation, and I want to make a difference because I want this to be a safe and better place for my children.
I signed the petition on the Architect and Engineers 9/11 Truth website mainly because I wanted to stand behind the families that lost people on 9/11. The 9/11 Truth movement was started by the families that lost loved ones on that day, and they were all out there alone screaming for help, and our own country was ignoring them and ignoring their needs and not taking care of them the way we should have after that happened.
We have not been told the truth. We deserve the truth, and so do the victims.
We need to come together again as a country. I believe that this one event split our country in half. And the only way we're going to come back together is to reopen the wound, talk about this in an open dialogue.
Most of us who have lived with the events of 9/11 have, as a result, experienced some kind of trauma. It can be very difficult to come to terms with what actually happened at the World Trade Center. In fact, someone told me recently, "I wouldn't believe what you're telling me even if it were true." Our petition signers, with psychological expertise, have stepped forward to offer their insight. While this segment is clearly outside the knowledge base of the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, these experts in psychology highlight their valuable experience for us as to why this evidence can still be so difficult for people to accept.
At this point, we have 9 years of hard scientific evidence that disproves the government theory about what happened on September 11th, and yet people continue to be either oblivious to the fact that this information exists or completely resistant to looking at this information. So the question becomes, why? Why is it that people have so much trouble hearing this information? From my work, I think we would be remiss not to look at the impact of trauma. My name is Marty Hopper, and I'm a PhD clinical psychologist. I've been working and living for the past 30 years here in Boulder, Colorado. For the past 11 years, my work has focused on helping people who have experienced personal trauma. Now, as we know, the horrors of what happened on 9/11 were televised all over the world, and they were televised, in fact, live. We witnessed the deaths of almost 3,000 of our fellow Americans. We know this had a very severe and traumatic impact on a majority of the population. I myself cried for weeks after September 11th. A friend of mine who is a psychologist in practice here in Boulder said that her caseload increased tremendously after 9/11, and people that she hadn't seen in 10 years were coming back into her practice. So I think it's safe to say that collectively as a nation, because of what happened on September 11th, we experienced trauma.
I'm Fran Schur, and I have a master's degree from the University of Colorado. I've had a private practice as a psychotherapist and as a licensed professional counselor for about 20 years. Why do people resist this information, the information that shows that the official story about 9/11 cannot be true? What I've learned is that as humans, each of us have a worldview, and that worldview is usually formed in great part by the culture we grow up in. When we hear information that contradicts our worldview, social psychologists call the resulting insecurity cognitive dissonance. For example, with 9/11, we have one cognition, which is what the official story of 9/11, what our government told us, what our media repeated to us over and over, that 19 Muslims attacked us. On the other hand, we have what scientists, researchers, architects, engineers are now beginning to tell us, which is that there is evidence that shows that the official story cannot be true. So now we've lost our sense of security. We are starting to feel vulnerable. Now we're confused.
9/11 truth challenges some of our most fundamental beliefs about our government and about our country. When your beliefs are challenged or when two beliefs are inconsistent, cognitive dissonance is created. 9/11 truth challenges the beliefs that our country protects us and keeps us safe and that America is the good guy. My name is Bob Hopper, and I have a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Cincinnati. For the past 29 years, I've been a licensed PhD clinical psychologist in Boulder, Colorado. When your beliefs are challenged, fear and anxiety are created. In response to that, our psychological defenses kick in, and they protect us from these emotions. Denial, which is probably the most primitive psychological defense, is the one most likely to kick in when our beliefs are challenged.
I'm Danielle Dupre, PhD, originally from Switzerland, where I studied psychology and psychoanalysis. For the past 15 years, I've been empowering people who have experienced significant trauma. America is a powerful nation. It has never been attacked. We were confident, we felt secure, and all of a sudden that security collapsed. People started to be fearful. With all those rumors, those news, people didn't know what to think about. And it's a very, very uncomfortable state to be in. And eventually, our mind shuts off. Just like when a computer is overloaded, our minds get overloaded. We can't handle it anymore, and we shut down. It's easier to deny it and move on with our lives.
What some of us will tend to do is deny the evidence that's coming our way and stick to the original story, the official story, and to try to regain our equilibrium in that way. Another thing we can do is decide to look at the conflicting evidence and be sincere and be open-minded and look at both sides of the issue and then make up our own mind about what reality is.
I'm Dorothy Lorig. I have a master's degree in counseling psychology from the University of Colorado, and I've been practicing reevaluation counseling for over 16 years. If we can think of our worldview as being sort of our mental and emotional home, I think all of us will do just about anything to defend our homes, to defend our families. And so I see that with people, and I saw that with myself when my brother tried to talk with me about it, of don't mess with me, don't mess with my home, don't mess with my comfort with how things are. And about a week later, I read a lengthy article by Professor Griffin about why he believes the official account of 9/11 cannot be true. And it was a very well-researched article. I was in my office at the time. I sat there and I felt my stomach churning. I thought maybe I was going to be sick. And I leaped out of my chair and ran out the door and took a long walk around the block, around several blocks, and just broke down. I understand now that what was happening was my worldview about my government being in some way my protector, almost like a parent, had been dashed, and it was like being cast out into the wilderness, I think is the closest way to describe that feeling. And I sobbed and I sobbed, felt like the ground had completely disappeared beneath my feet, and I knew at some point during the walk that I knew that I was going to have to become active in educating other people about this, that there was, that for me to retain any sense of integrity, I was going to have to take some action. I couldn't just let something like this go.
Many people respond to these truths in a very deep way. Some have a visceral reaction like they've been punched in the stomach. To begin to accept the possibility that the government was involved is like opening Pandora's box. If you open the lid and peek in a little bit, it's going to challenge some of your fundamental beliefs about the world.
Well, here are a few of those spontaneous initial reactions to hearing the contradictory evidence about 9/11.
I don't want to know the truth, or I'd become too negative and psychologically go downhill. I'm not sure I want to know. If this is true, then up would be down and down would be up. My life would never be the same.
Fran, I refuse to believe that that many Americans could be that treasonous. Someone would have talked. But these are beliefs. They are not scientific facts. But these beliefs do keep us from looking at the empirical evidence.
I'm David Ray Griffin. I taught philosophy of religion and theology at the Claremont School of Theology and Claremont Graduate University. I published about 35 books in my field, but then starting in 2004, I started publishing about 9/11, and since that time, I have published 10 books about 9/11. You have empirical people who will simply say, look at the evidence, and if it's convincing, I will change my mind. Other people are paradigmatic people. They have a paradigm. They say, this is the way the world works, and I'm convinced this is the right way the world works. 9/11 doesn't fit into that paradigm, so I don't need to look at the evidence. It's paradigmatic. And then there is a third type of person that we often call wishful thinkers. I call it wishful and fearful thinking. So they simply will not believe something that they fear to be the truth. And I found that maybe to be the most powerful factor of people rejecting 9/11 truth and not even entertaining the evidence.
So whenever we say, I refuse to believe, we can be sure that the evidence that's coming our way is not bearable, and that it's conflicting with our worldview much too much.
Denial protects people from this kind of anxiety.
As I thought about all of these responses, I realized that what is common to every one of them is the emotion of fear. People are afraid of being ostracized, they're afraid of being alienated, they're afraid of being shunned, they're afraid of their lives being inconvenienced, they'd have to change their lives, they're afraid of being confused, they're afraid of psychological deterioration, they're afraid of feeling helpless and vulnerable, and they're afraid that they won't be able to handle the feelings that are coming up. None of us want to feel helpless and vulnerable, so we want to defend ourselves, and the way we often do that is with anger. So then we become angry. And when we become angry, then we become indignant. We become offended. We want to ridicule the messenger. We want to pathologize the messenger. And we want to censor the messenger.
So how can we overcome this resistance and denial? The first thing is to meet people where they're at.
One thing is that we need to raise people's awareness about this through what I would call gentle dialogue and gentle questioning. My name is John Freedom. I'm a counselor in private practice here in Tucson, Arizona. which I've been for the past 20 years. I hold a master's level certification in NLP, which is neuro-linguistic programming. So it doesn't work to challenge people's belief or immediately tell them, you know, I know the truth about 9/11, but a good way is to ask questions, ask open-ended questions, and lead them into a dialogue and discussion about it.
Healing comes through facing the truth, experiencing it, allowing the feelings to come in, so that if there are feelings of fear that perhaps these events were caused by something that we haven't thought about yet, dark elements within our society, for example, we'll let that come in and explore it. Let the light shine on whatever happened. This will be the most healing process. The Germans did this after their war. The South Africans did this after apartheid. Reconciliation through the truth is what is a deep path to psychological recovery from the myths and lies around which this historical event has been cloaked in the official view. I am Professor William Woodward. I'm trained in the history of science with a PhD. I also have a master's in experimental psychology. I've edited 4 books and published well over 20 peer-reviewed papers. I've taught for 35 years at a state university, the University of New Hampshire. I think as a psychologist, to overcome our fear of the traumatic event with new information would be the best, healthiest route to our collective recovery from the trauma of 9/11. That, by the way, is a psychotherapeutic insight that to gradually uncover the truth in your own life, the sources of anxiety, to make them conscious, is the royal road to recovery.
One of the ways to deal with the trauma is to find the answers. That's why I think it is of such importance to have a comprehensive investigation.
To work together to expose what happened, regardless of where the evidence takes us. That's what we expect in our state government, law enforcement. I think that by putting science together with the law, we will have a psychological healing around the impossible cognition that has been produced on that day.
I believe that to be the kind of country that we think we are, we have to face some of the things that are not as we think they are.
I'm Robert Griffin. I am a licensed psychologist practicing in Pennsylvania for 25 years. I am a member of Psychologists for Social Responsibility, and I am past president of the Northeastern Pennsylvania Psychological Association. After World War II, part of the way that Jewish people honored the dead was by making sure that the truth was known and that the value of these people was respected. Not pursuing the truth about 9/11 disrespects the value of the life of the people that died. Thinking that we're above such things, that it could happen in other countries, but it couldn't happen here, that's a lack of humility, and that's excessive pride. And so not being able to see our dark side or our weaknesses is the most dangerous thing.
The observation that pride is one of the basic human flaws is absolutely correct. This is especially true for Americans because we for a long time looked at other nations and say, oh, they're in such bad shape, but luckily we don't have those problems. We don't have leaders who would do those things that were done in the Soviet Union or done in Germany or done in Japan and on down the list. So this is a type of pride that Americans have. A feature of American history that makes us particularly liable to this pride is this notion that's called exceptionalism, that America is the exceptional nation. And that began from the beginning, as this country was formed. The people would say, well, there was so much evil in the European country, so much cheating, so much lying, so much using the people for the ruler's purposes, but not in America. We have leaders that are free from those sins. So I think this has made 9/11 particularly difficult for Americans.
Anyone can make mistakes, but our ideals and our principles get us back, you know, on track.
This is one of the defining issues of our time.
So we need to understand that questioning is patriotic. Questioning is what we're supposed to do as citizens. That's our duty.
When we come to the national level, when something like 9/11 happens, we need to be sure that we have a real investigation into who the perpetrators are, and then we need to be sure that those perpetrators are held legally accountable. It's part of the healing process on the individual level as on the collective level. We need the truth in order to heal.
10 years later, the deep wounds from 9/11 have yet to heal. Nothing hits closer to home than the loss that these family members continue to endure, along with the torment of their unanswered questions.
My name is Bob McElveen. I'm from right outside the Philadelphia area, and I'm the father of Bobby McElveen, who was killed in the lobby of the North Tower on September 11, 2001. But I've been searching to get the truth of exactly what happened to Bobby, and Bobby is a very interesting story. Bobby was one of the first 10 bodies found. We took him home that week. We were one of the few. Well, I finally found the doctor who examined him. He gave me an outline of a body, and he described all the injuries he had. But the fact is that all his injuries were in the face, the front of his face was blown off, massive cuts in his chest and his right arm were blown off. To me, that means explosion.
My brother was my best friend. David has always been a firefighter. My brother went in to save people's lives. I'm a family member trying to find out the answers to the murder of 3,000 plus people.
I'm Jane Policino. My husband Steve was 48 years old when he was killed on September 11th. I have no identification. You know, why is that? And you're sort of left with all these question marks, which is harder to deal with than the pain of losing somebody in that way. It seems to me we should know why over 1,000 victims there are no trace for, and no identification, no trace of over 1,000 victims.
Just a few years ago, they were still finding body parts on the roofs of buildings. What is that?
We should know why there are over 700 bone fragments found on the top of Deutsche Bank building less than a half an inch long. We should have that information. Why were they up there? Why weren't they found? What kind of explosion was there?
And the explosions were brought up many a times, talking to firemen, talking to medics, talking to everyone. Everybody talked about these explosions.
I want the officials that are in power to ask the questions. I want answers. We never had answers. Nobody ever stopped to have a scientific investigation.
Please look at architects and engineers. People all around the world, scientists all around the world, are questioning this, that these towers could not have come down. But when you bring science into the equation, that's so important because you can't argue against science. And there's some deep, deep explaining to do.
The bottom line is that it needs to be investigated properly.
The forensic evidence that you've seen is very real. New light has been shown. A third beam now reaches into the pitch black sky and stands in for the still officially unexplained freefall destruction of the World Trade Center Building 7. The obvious dark truth about Building 7 may very well provide the key to justice for the victims of the destruction of the Twin Towers.
The country owns this.
We were all victims. You all should want answers, not just ours, not just mine. We all lost something that day.
You've been fantastic, and I hope you enjoyed it.
There is a point.
Is there a point to all this?
Let's find a point.
Is there a point to my act? I would say there is.
I have to. The world is like a ride at an amusement park. And when you choose to go on it, you think it's real, because that's how powerful our minds are. And the ride goes up and down and round. It has thrills and chills, and it's very brightly colored, and it's very loud. And it's fun for a while. Some people have been on the ride for a long time, and they begin to question, is this real, or is this just a ride? And other people have remembered, and they come back to us, and they say, hey, don't worry, don't be afraid, ever, because this is just a ride. And we kill those people.
Shut him up.
We have a lot invested in this ride. Shut him up. Look at my furrows of worry. Look at my big bank account and my family. This has to be real. It's just a ride. But we always kill those good guys who try and tell us that. You ever notice that? And let the demons run amok. But it doesn't matter, because it's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace. Thank you very much. You've been great. I hope you enjoyed it. London, you're fantastic. Thank you. Thank you very much.
So